and welcome everybody.
Senate Transportation Committee is also called to order, and thank you for being here today. What we're going to do, I'll take our first topic today, and Chairman Beyer will run the rest of our meeting. I know we have some people on a short string here, and I really appreciate them coming. So we're going to open up an informational meeting on TriNet Light Rail. I have some comments on that, but I'm going to save them for the end so that we can have the people make their comments first and put that in context to what we hear today. I think most members are familiar with some of the issues that certainly have been very well publicized regarding TriNet, and so I have asked some of the individuals who have been really involved in this issue to come forward and maybe share some light on that with us. And with that, I'm going to ask Mayor Shane Bemis to come forward. And Mayor, you can bring Chief Peluso forward and Chief. Why don't we do this all at once? Chief Ashenbrenner, also come forward, and we'll let you start, Mr. Mayor, and take us away and give us your perspective on the issues. And I'm sure we'll have some interesting dialogue.
Thank you, Chairman Metzger, Chairwoman Beyer, members of the House Senate Transportation Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today about an issue that hits really close to home in Gresham. For the record, my name is Shane Bemis, and I am the mayor of Gresham. Today I will speak a little bit about how we got where we are, the scope of the issues that we face, and present a couple of ideas about how maybe we can move forward in the future. As mayor, one of the most frequently occurring issues I've heard from citizens is that they are afraid to use MACs and feel unsafe when they are using it. This is a difficult message for me to hear because MAX is such an important community asset and community amenity. Thousands of our citizens use it each day to move throughout the region. I'd like to say a few words about how we got here. I doubt that there's probably a citizen left in Gresham who's not aware that public safety is our top priority. In March, we convened a public safety summit and brought together all of our regional law enforcement stakeholders along with members of our community. The public safety summit was really a turning point for us because we acknowledged that there were areas in our city in which we were struggling with crime, and we began to find ways to address those issues. Since the summit, members of the community have approached me about increasing concerns about the safety of the MAX line. My initial reaction was to suggest that these concerns go to TriMet, as has been the case in the past, because they're traditionally in charge of security on the light rail line. Some of these issues can get mired in bureaucratic muck of jurisdiction, responsibility, and finger-pointing over whose job it is to provide a safe line. However, I knew at the end of the day that the responsibility for the safety and security of our citizens rests in our hands. It was time for the city to take decisive action. There will be plenty of times as we progress to continue this discussion with TriMet, and I know that they're holding a public safety summit similar to the one we held in March. The bottom line is that this is more of an issue than simply perception, and I believe that they are beginning to acknowledge the problem and take constructive steps forward. We know the scope of the issues that we face. We recently released crime data that shows a correlation between crime and proximity to light rail platforms. Attached to the written testimony, you will find a map that shows crime cases and calls and the proximity to light rail, along with statistics showing what is happening nearby. We learned that 84% of our gang calls, 41% of our drug cases, 40% of our fight calls, and 40% of our robbery cases all happen within a 3 or 4 minute walk to a light rail platform. Another frequent message that I'm hearing is that there's not as many people paying their fare as ought to be. This may not seem like a big deal, but little things make big differences, and I believe that the responsible fare-paying riders are much less likely to cause crime and be a nuisance on the line. Last year, TriMet wrote less than 4 skip fare citations a day within the city of Gresham, and the year before that, less than 1 a day. Now, I'm a trusting guy, but I got to believe that there's a lot more people riding light rail free than those numbers suggest. As a result of that overwhelming message we have been hearing from the community and the staggering statistical data we discovered, we made the decision to place our own Gresham police officers on board MAX trains to check for fare, enforce TriMet code, enforce the law, and provide a vital police presence. The feedback we have received from the community has been universally positive, and our officers report that they feel like their activities are very fruitful. We will be keeping careful data and statistics throughout this effort, and as we progress through the statistics to target our own enforcement and keep the regional dialogue open about how we feel we can best make the system safer for everybody. I have a few ideas about how we should move forward, and last Friday, TriMet Director Fred Hansen and I sat down and discussed the idea of possibly closing or gating a stop in Gresham as a pilot project to ensure that everybody who boards the train gets off the train and the stop has a valid fare. I'm very supportive of this proposal, and I hope that we can move forward with it quickly. a longer-term solution, I believe that it is time for the elected officials and policymakers to talk about the elephant in the room. We will never have the type of long-term reform we need on MAX without moving to the direction of an entire gated system where nobody can get on the train without a valid fare. I'm aware that this is a costly proposal, but successful systems around the country are much more vigilant on this issue, and I believe it is to their benefit. Of course, in the immediate future, I firmly believe that TriMet needs to have an increased police presence on the light rail line. This could be quickly accomplished by getting at least a portion of the existing TriMet police force officers out of their patrol cars and onto the trains. I do not believe that TriMet and the city will be able to fully restore the trust of the public until we begin the proactive police presence and move forward. Finally, we have to begin to work toward physical changes to the system. Light rail in Gresham is 20 years old, and it's showing its age. Stations were not designed with passenger security in mind. That is why Gresham and TriMet are partnering to pursue the Connect Oregon grant to rebuild the Rockwood 188th Light Rail Station. Again, thank you for the opportunity to give testimony today. This is an issue that strikes to the core of our city's livability, and I appreciate your attention to the matter. Thank you.
I think we'll hear from all three panelists, and then we'll have questions. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Chair Beyer, Senator Metzger. Thanks for your time this afternoon. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, and I'm honored to be the Gresham Police Chief. As our mayor has stated, issues related to light rail have been brewing in our city for a long period of time. And in my career in law enforcement, I have learned that perception can easily be reality. I'd like to say right off, this is not an attack on the TriMet police unit, nor is it an attack on TriMet itself. We value light rail in our community. We just find that there is a need to enhance some aspects, especially in the area of security, so that our citizens feel safe and welcomed on light rail. Again, with the handouts you've received, you have two documents from the Gresham Police Department that are not very clearly marked, I must say. Well, one says in handwriting on the top, January 1, 2007 to current, which is today, 735. That's 735 reported crimes on MAX itself or the light rail property in the city of Gresham from January 1 to today. And as you thumb through those, it covers everything from offensive littering to disorderly conduct, cocaine issues, a lost cell phone, robberies, assault too. So all I ask is in your time to kind of look through that and see the myriad and the variety of incidents that we have dealt with in the last 11 months. In addition, you have a single page that talks about our calls to light rail stations. And again, I brought both documents because a police call does not always generate a crime stat. So we look at two different things, and it is the calls for service that really drive our staffing levels and our needs. So again, those two documents are available to you. About almost a year ago, well, actually almost 11 months ago, on December 18th, 2006, the Gresham Police Department received a report of a fight involving seven subjects, one of whom had been stabbed. In investigating that case, we learned that this exchange, this fight, actually began at the MAX train at 148th, traveling eastbound. Needless to say, the situation escalated, and this was during daylight hours, early afternoon, escalated into a homicide right within a block of exiting the light rail station. We were able to apprehend the suspect. We believe it was gang-related, and he is currently awaiting trial for murder. As you all have seen on the media last a week ago Saturday, we had a 71-year-old assaulted on light rail, brutally assaulted. We have a young man awaiting arraignment this week on felony assault, murder charges, and some criminal mischief relating to his spray painting of graffiti on a MAX train, all the same incident. We started less than a week ago assigning our officers to light rail, to the MAX trains, the section within our city, to just provide a presence. The first day, and again, we're talking daylight hours, we started at 10 a.m., 22 people were excluded from MAX. And I can't remember, I apologize, I wasn't told which day of the week it was, one of the officers gave people the option of leaving the train if they had not paid their fare. I was told better than 70% cleared off the train. And as I was driving down here today, I heard our officers assigned to the detail go 1061, which in our code means they have a suspect in custody, and they were traveling on light rail to the appropriate stop where their police car was parked to take that individual off the train. The problem is real. The problem exists. We are here to partner with light rail and all members of our community, all members and citizens along the light rail line to bring, again, that sense of security and the want to ride on our trains, because when the right population is on that train, the wrong population will stay off. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Welcome.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Chief Lila Ashenbrenner, Hillsborough Police Department. I certainly want to echo the mayor and the chief's comments that they've made. We are here to partner to work out our issues with TriMet and obviously to go forward and see a little bit of change. We're on the west side, probably the forgotten child, if you will. We don't seem to get quite as much attention as what we consider east of the tunnel. Issues nevertheless, and what I have provided for you today, and quickly I'll just kind of walk you through the graphs. On the first page, you'll look at calls for service by station. Hillsborough has 9 platforms or stations in Hillsborough. Beaverton has 3 for a total of 12 on the west side, and we consider anything west of the tunnel the west side. When you look at those, obviously you'll see 3 or 4 stations that have higher call loads than others. With light rail comes high density housing and very large low income housing units that are right next to light rail. Where those apartment complexes are the typically where you're going to see the higher calls for service. Again, when you look at the bottom graph, those are how many man hours or woman hours are spent by station at the light rail.
If I can interrupt just for a moment.
Yes.
If you could articulate, when you say calls for service, what would that entail in general?
You either have a 911 call, which is an emergency call, or you have a non-emergency call, which is obviously lesser statute, or you have self-initiated activities by the officers. So this graph encompasses all 3 of those.
Thank you.
The second page is an example of a information that we send to TriMet on a monthly basis. Hillsborough has tracked our stats, and every month we send those off to TriMet so they have an idea of what we're dealing with on the west side, what our calls for service are. If you look, you've got September and October for 2007. It shows the calls for service at the stations. In October it was 301, September 235 total calls for service. It shows the hours, and again you can look this over and get an idea of the amount of time that we're spending on those 9 stations in our city. Third page again is max calls for service by station. This is just for the year of 2007. And again, you can see the numbers that we're experiencing. And at the bottom, the 3 different colors, the blue are the 911 emergency calls, the red are the non-emergency calls, and then the yellow are self-initiated by our officers that are either assigned to the trains or working that district. The next graph, again, just shows 2006, so you start to get an idea of what the trend is by different year. The next page shows each month calls for service, January through August, and again, just what the trend is by month. The next graph is for 2006, the same thing as the one for 2007, and again, just to show you the comparison of 2 years so you get a flavor of the trend. And then the last graph shows stats from 2002 to 2006, and those are, again, calls for service by year and self-initiated calls, which are those are the ones initiated by the officers. So it shows total numbers. And then the last couple pages just give you a sampling of crimes that we have dealt with in Hillsborough on the light rail. I'm sure that Chief Peluso, Chief Rosie Sizer, and I would all agree. You know, typically we deal with the same things. There's a lot of the, you know, smaller crimes that occur, but a lot of the more serious ones as well. One issue that we dealt with was a subject on the train got off, had a padlock on a chain, started swinging it around, actually broke out one of the windows, was extremely violent, threatening towards people, scared a lot of people on the train. We ended up attempting to tase him. That was unsuccessful. We used less lethal and were able to take him into custody with less lethal. Certainly a deadly force situation. Thank goodness we didn't have to go there. So Hillsborough was asked to participate. Well, we started conversations with TriMet back in 1993 when we first started looking at TriMet coming to Hillsborough about participating. We requested cameras on our stations. Those funds were lost with the tunnel because that was so expensive is what we were told. We were asked to participate on the TriMet security. Hillsborough refused to participate because we could not be guaranteed that our officers that we would assign would be west of the tunnel. We have seen a lack of presence on the west side of the tunnel to deal with these issues. The good news is currently we do have a meeting scheduled with TriMet to look at the west side and to see what we can do. So with that, we're looking to move forward and have a good resolution to this, but happy to answer any questions that you've got.
Okay, thank you. I'll begin, and then we'll open it up to questions from the committee, and then we'll be hearing from TriMet. First of all, Mr. Mayor, I want to congratulate you, first of all, for your aggressiveness in dealing with an issue. I think it's much better to, in my view, to grapple with an issue forthright, even if maybe some of the elements may not be the best elements or the right elements, than to sit there and cogitate about what you know is a problem. And I think that you've shown real leadership on that issue. And it's unfortunate that you had to take those types of steps, but you did the right thing. And I think the citizens in the Gresham area, in fact, throughout the line, I think really appreciate that. I made a comment a while back, and to some folks from TriMet as well, last spring. You might remember, colleagues, we were dealing with an issue of safety with crossing guards, with the young man, Mr. Sturdy, who had died and being hit. And so the issue of safety in a lot of realms came up. And I did my own little experiment in my private business. I had an office in the Hollywood District right by Hollywood Max, and my folks live in Gresham. And so sometimes I would take that line, park at the Gresham station, and then go into Hollywood. And there's a number of observations I made from that, as well as some other travels on the line. Number one was, to be totally candid, I had to admit that I do not feel safe on Max after night, and I won't ride it at night. You know, unless you're with a group of folks, I really don't feel safe from what my own observations are. My folks who have gone to ball games and stuff at Civic Stadium like that during the day also do not feel safe and will not ride it at night. In contrast, it is really interesting because last week or 2 weeks ago I was in Washington, D.C., been there many times, I'm sure a lot of you have, or Chicago or New York. I will tell you, even though Washington's probably the biggest crime next to maybe St. Louis in the United States, I have absolutely no problem riding all night long on Metro in D.C. or New York or Chicago. I do not feel unsafe. And they have built into the infrastructure safety, you know, so it's not the fortress mentality. It's not that you have to see a lot of cops or anything, but they have built a system of safety. You know, they have duress alarms. There's all kinds of things that that the bad guys know that's not the place to be interfering. And it is a sad commentary to be in my hometown area of Gresham and feel I can't ride mass transit. I don't feel comfortable riding, and I can go to crime-infested cities and feel very comfortable riding. So just from a personal observation. And then one of those trips and it was in April, when I boarded from Hollywood to go back to Gresham, identified folks who I thought looked like 23 or under. You know, made sure they knew I was not a fare inspector. I was doing a little survey, and I talked to 12 younger people about whether they really had a ticket. And four of the 12 people actually had a ticket, and the other eight did not. So I think that your immediate statistics certainly seem to validate that fact. Now, we have some infrastructure issues, certainly. We are built this on a kind of an honor system. Unfortunately, it's become a conduit of crime, I believe, for dishonorable conduct. And I think part of the infrastructure, as you alluded to, Mr. Mayor, actually serves that particular objective. And while there are costs involved, I think if we're going to have light rail or any types of mass transit, which is so critical. It is such, and I'm a big booster of that, as everyone knows, that people, if they don't feel safe using it, then that's an investment that's not doing what it's supposed to do. And I think that is a real, real critical element. I also think that as we're looking to expanding, you know, down to Clackamas, down in my district, and through Representative Tomei's district, we don't want to create any more conduits of crime, and we need to really address this issue in partnership, as you have said, with TriMet, with our local government leaders, and so that we can come up with a solution so that public transit is public transit, and you can go any time of the day and feel like you are gaining the benefits of the system. And I think if we we move away, you mentioned perception is reality. I'm an old news guy. Perception is reality. And then we have real reality as well. But we need to move off of that and find some real solutions and stop putting this under the rug and realize that if it's going to serve the community has to want to feel comfortable using the system. So those are my comments and my congratulations. I want you to know you have a council meeting at 3 o'clock, correct?
Yes.
I want you to know that the mayor has his council meeting, Gresham, at 3 o'clock, but thought this issue was so important that he would come down, and that's why I wanted to get him on right away. So in recognition of time, I do want to have questions, but I know the mayor will want to get going as soon as he possibly can. So questions from the committee from this panel. Representative Tomei.
This is not for the mayor, so if somebody has questions of the mayor, they might want to ask that.
Well, go ahead, right. Go ahead.
Okay. This is for Chief... Oh, I've forgotten your name.
Lisa
Ashenbrenner. Thank you. I'm referring to your chart,
mm-hmm.
and it looks like in January of 06, there were 358 calls from, and they were down to 209 now. This was, you know, it's one of
in December of 06, yes.
Right. So it looks like they went down. That seems...
Hillsboro, we have long-term have two officers that are assigned to light rail, specifically downtown area. They do travel other parts of it. But when we couldn't get the, a west side team going, then Hillsboro saw the same need as Gresham did, and a long time ago, we assigned officers to that. Depending what's going on, we have a street crimes unit that will be assigned there as well. So depending on the trends, again, we might see different activities. It goes up and it goes down depending on when we can have people assigned. Again, they're not dedicated 100% of the time to light rail because obvious other calls for service, but that's their main focus is to spend time on that.
And the next slide also, it looks like from 2002 when there were over 3,100 calls, and then down in 06 you had a little over 1,000. So
yes, and
it really helped.
Yes, absolutely. Having the presence on that train absolutely does make a difference.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, this is for the mayor and for anyone else involved in this issue, and that is my concern is that we know this is a conduit of crime. We know that there are a lot of problems in, around, and very close to these stations. But we also know from the comments that have been made by the chair that this isn't unknown in other cities, in other metropolitan areas in the United States. Why didn't we, as we were constructing these rails and putting the cars on, why did we believe that we were going to be exempt from those kinds of problems as we move these rails through these various cities and in these areas?
Was that a question for me or time? I don't quite know how to answer your question, Representative, but I will say that I believe that TriMet is committed to moving forward and finding solutions, as you heard from the other chiefs. I believe we've moved to a new position, which is that this is a reality and we need to deal with it. In my conversation with Mr. Hansen, I believe that we are at that point. And as the Senator Metzger pointed out, that this is a huge community asset, and we have a lot of our historic downtown Gresham. We have one stop, and it's the stop that the chief alluded to earlier where there was a gang homicide. It's the stop where 71-year-old victim was beaten a week ago. So we have huge investments into that area that run parallel to light rail, and we know that light rail needs to service them. So we're you know, we're ready to help in any way we can to make this a success.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And this really isn't a question, but it goes back to the whole issue. And perhaps you weren't the mayor at the time.
No.
But I'm going to say this, and that is that before this rail moves through to other locations, my hope is that city and local officials would take a real close examination to make sure that it is going to be an asset to the community as opposed to just a conduit of crime to feed into that community. And hopefully that the MAX folks and the light rail folks will be able to respond to the concerns that we've got, why it is that we feel like we're exempt. If I was in Representative Tomei's district today, I would say, hey, wait a minute, I don't think I want that sewer line pumping into my district and dumping off there, if that's truly the case.
Senator, if I may, I think one of the issues that we experienced initially when we saw TriMet coming in is we went to them, we made the requests for the cameras, for the security, but again, at that point in time, I think because of the funding, that created some of the issues we weren't able to institute this in the beginning. Hopefully now that time has passed, we've moved past that and we'll be able to have the funding so that we can move forward.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to pick up, Chief, on what you just started to mention there on sort of proactive activities, and particularly with the graph here that refers to self-initiated sorts of things. I'm wondering if, apart from additional officers and additional funding, what other sorts of things would you like to be able to do or would you like to see as proactive measures?
Well, I think one of the things that the mayor mentioned is environmental design could be a huge asset for law enforcement. These stations now are designed so that anybody can walk in or out from any direction. If we're approaching a station because there's an issue on it, we like to have the ability to corral, if you will, the people that we want to contact and not have them run in 360 different directions. So, again, if we look at some environmental design at each one of the platforms that... I believe that it's been done downtown. They've put up some fencing at one of them, and it is assisting law enforcement when we have to respond. That's certainly one thing. I think philosophically, TriMet is an open station, unlike BART and Washington, D.C., which are closed. You have to have a ticket to get in. The philosophy is different, and I'm not saying that that's what we should go to, but we can certainly look at some environmental designs that could assist us.
Thank you. And Chief Peluso, did you have any suggestions?
Again, I agree 100%, and as the mayor stated, we're very encouraged that there is a possibility that one of our soon-to-be-open stations might be able to utilize some of those environmental opportunities. I also think there's an opportunity for citizens to become engaged on back to the old crime watch, crime prevention, you know, the eyes and the ears. But I have until we get our trains safe, I'm not going to feel comfortable having our citizens serve that role. But I do think that's an opportunity in the future to engage our citizens in the safety of their community.
And if I may, one other thing, too. Cameras would obviously be an asset and a deterrent. Help us solve crimes when they do occur. But if somebody knows that they're being watched on camera, there's an impact there as well.
Thank you. Thanks.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Mayor, you're pretty new on the job, and I want to congratulate you on the way you've handled this situation. It would have been very easy for you to tell folks, well, that's TriMet's problem, pass the buck. Some public officials have tended to do that, but you haven't done that. Instead, you've said this is a collective problem that we need to solve, and you've expressed a willingness to work with other officials, with the police agencies, and with TriMet, to try and make these lines safer for all of us. I ride MAX frequently. I even ride it at night. I think every time I've ridden it at night, it's been back from a sports event, and it's been a crowded train. And I think the more people on the train, the safer it feels, really, which may seem like an oxymoron, but I think when you only have a few people on that train and maybe a couple of them are bad guys, that's when you feel a little danger. Anyway, thank you very much for your work and your efforts.
Any other questions for these folks? Well, thank you very much, and
thank you.
And thank your council for their patience and having your delay to get there.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey. Ask Mr. Hansen, TriMet, to come forward, please. You said you don't. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair as well. For the record, I'm Fred Hansen. I am the General Manager of TriMet, and I appreciate very much the opportunity to be able to be here and to be able to follow what Mayor Bemis and our two police chiefs, both in Gresham and Hillsborough, were able to address. Let me maybe just say a few things, and I want to be able to get to both a six-point plan that I announced at the beginning on November 5th, to be able to address some of these issues and the commitment that you heard earlier to be able to work together to find ways to be able to address the issues that are all of us as jurisdictions responsible for and needing to be able to address. But the partnership is what I think is particularly key. I think that all of us deplore the heinous nature of the attack on Mr. Chilcote in Gresham at the Gresham Central Station on last Saturday night. And as I said, I really do applaud Mayor Bemis to be able to have stepped up and assisting with security. I think that's something that you also heard from Police Chief Ashenbrenner in Hillsborough, utilizing their police force to be able to augment the TriMet police force as well. And I want to come back to be able to describe a little bit about what that TriMet police force is, because they are not sworn officers of TriMet, but rather on loan to us from other jurisdictions. The goal I have is that I want everyone who either rides TriMet or would like to ride TriMet to feel safe and secure. And as ridership is increasing, on the MAX system alone, we have about 104,000 boardings every day, about two times that on the bus side. But the focus certainly here has been on the MAX side. Generally, that probably means somewhere around 50,000 or so people. That is, most people who are riding the system are generally going somewhere place and then coming back from that to that place. So in terms of actual individuals, somewhere around 50,000 or so individuals on a daily basis. As I think we recognize, that is a small city in our region, or maybe even kind of a bit more of a medium-sized a city. And the issues around the problems that exist in any city are what we really have also, because it's a mobile city. We are moving through jurisdictions. And the problems that are associated with that are ones that really affect that broader definition of what that community is about. As I said, to increase the overall security on the system, I have taken a number of steps announced, and I'll come back to that. But I think it's important to be able to put a little bit of history to be able to recognize, and I think that Representative Butler asked about what did this community think about when they were originally installing light rail. Back in the 1980s, as this was being planned, there were only three light rail systems, or two other light rail systems in the nation that made use of this type of light rail. But even there, the Portland region chose to be able to experiment with making it a part of the community itself, making it really a part of the streetscape. And probably no place is more obvious in that than at Pioneer Square at the heart of the city of Portland, where you really have sidewalks that are in fact serving as as platforms for boarding or deboarding TriMet MAX trains, but it's also a part of the streetscape. And the concept certainly at that point was to be able to really see that this was a part of the community. And in that, the history was that as the transit police, that is the part of the system that TriMet addressed, was really looking narrowly, and this is something I think, again, I'll come back to, but I think that Mayor Bemis has really focused on that we need to think more comprehensively about that. But at that time, when we were, when the system was coming up, was really focused specifically on the line itself, in the trains, and immediately on the platforms themselves, and that the rest of the activity that oftentimes occurred was a part of the jurisdictions, whether it be a city or whether it be unincorporated areas in either Multnomah or Washington counties.
the effort was really very different than what is one sees in whether it be Washington D.C., where I certainly have lived and worked in the mid 1990s, but it's whether it's there or New York or St. Louis or other places, even Los Angeles, their systems are generally either underground, that is, a clear way of having a turnstile to go through before you get onto into the platform or onto the vehicle. Or even when they are, in fact, above ground, they generally tend to be platforms that are isolated, either at a raised platform or separate from a streetscape that is not a part of sidewalks. And that is a very different item. And not to say that this region shouldn't rethink that, but it was a conscious decision when these initial investments were made to be able to make it a part of the streetscape, to be able to make it a part of the activities that were on the street, not just a transporter of people, but also a part of that streetscape. Let me, if I can, maybe just say a moment about how the Transit Police Division within TriMet operates, because this is something that grew out of the history. Although in the very beginning days of light rail, post-1986, there actually technically was a police function that was sworn officers that were employed by TriMet, actually sworn officers within the TriMet system. That was abandoned in about mid-1980s. Period, and in fact moved to a place where the officers were ones that were from jurisdictions throughout the community, and that TriMet would pay for the full cost of those officers, currently 36 sworn officers budgeted, and 29 currently serving officers out of that Transit Police Division. Those officers come from principally from the city of Portland Police Bureau, but also are from locations such as Milwaukee, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, other jurisdictions, City of Beaverton, although you heard from Chief Ashenbrenner that Hillsborough had not participated as a part of that function. Those officers are ones who do respond to not only transit police issues, but also to general police matters if they are, in fact, the closest. Assume what happens. A 911 call comes in. Closest officer responds. If that is a transit police officer, they may, in fact, respond to something that's totally off of the system, having nothing to do with it. And likewise, if the closest officer is somebody, if it's in East Portland, that would be from the Portland Police Bureau, and they might respond to an incident that actually is on the TriMet system, on a train or not. And that sharing back and forth is something that historically has happened and would continue to be able to happen, it would seem to me. We need to be able to find those ways, as Mayor Bemis indicated, to be able to do more and better partnering. When he and I did talk also on last Friday, we talked about explicitly what he mentioned, and that is, should we do a pilot where we really close one of our platforms in Gresham to be able to really see if we can, in fact, by hardening that platform, really have a single point of entry onto the platform or off, might in fact help address not only the issue of are people coming on or off that have a fare, but also, as the chiefs said, the ability, if in fact there is a response to a crime, that you can in fact get your arms around all the potential players that are involved in that. Let me, if I may, turn to the six-point plan that I announced on November 5th. Number one is that we want to be able to make sure that all of the partnerships that are important across the region are enhanced. And I think that Mayor Bemis pointed out where some of those issues were a bit more frayed than I think we would like to be able to see, and we need to do that. Consequently, I announced that I would have be calling a summit now scheduled for November 30th on the west side, and look toward also having a second summit and possibly a third summit, the second summit being in the area on the east side, although certainly Gresham would be a part of that, really wanting to focus on the east precinct of the city of Portland, and possibly a third one, as I indicated, going into Clackamas County. Not only is there are issues around Clackamas County from the standpoint of the amount of unincorporated areas, but the cities that are there too. How do we really work together on that? And as I say, we're looking toward that summit as a way to be able to have a dialogue on how do we really find those opportunities to be able to better partner. All of the police, certainly us as well, have limited resources. How do we make the most out of those resources? And to me, I believe that those are a part of what, in fact, I would expect to be able to come from the summits. And I might stress at this stage that I am open to any model different from what we are doing or enhanced against what we are doing, but to be able to think new about this, because as I've said, the history of the TriMet light rail system had been really starting with it being a part of the streetscape, but now that we've really become the equivalent of a mobile city, how do we want to address differently the issues that are there? Are there types of crimes, such as drug dealing, that are more prevalent on a transit system, whereas maybe other crimes, prostitution, others, would not be? We need to be able to find what is actually occurring close to those lines, not just on the system as we've historically done, but to be able to find ways to be able to, by partnership, addressing the key issues. The second point of my six-point plan was to be able to review all 64 stations, platforms on the light rail system, as well as transit centers. And by the way, transit centers are often, though not solely, associated with where a MAX platform is, but there's also lots of connections with buses. Gateway is a very good example of that in the East County area, where there's lots of bus activity coming in and out. It is also associated with light rail. And how do we really make sure we look at that? Though that review has been looking at improving some of the physical structure at it, improving lighting, trimming back vegetation that, in fact, does not preserve sight lines, ensuring that we remove any, again, additional structures that may allow for people to hide behind it, and, therefore, people who are on the system waiting at that platform do not feel safe because they can't see who's behind it or what kind of a activity is there. At the end of the business today, all stations on east of the river have been reviewed, as well as Beaverton Transit Center, and we have, in fact, increased the lighting levels at three Gresham light rail stations, at the Cleveland, Gresham Central, and Gresham City Hall station platforms, as well as by the November 30th of this month, we'll be adding additional solar lighting at 82nd Street. We believe that that is a part of the steps, but it's just the beginning of those steps to be able to ensure that we have moved forward. Next, we want to be able to focus on the graffiti that is there. I think that you have certainly heard from the police, I think we all know it, that when graffiti appears in the system, if it's not removed quickly, it tends to be able to be, one, the way gangs communicate with one another or establish territory, but it is also, the faster it can be removed, the less likely that it is seen as a place that you continue to be able to put graffiti. We believe that's very important. My standard is to be at all of our light rail stations and our transit centers to be able to remove graffiti within 24 hours of being spotted. Those are things that are absolutely key, we think, to be able to move that forward. Next, our cameras. The cameras, we currently have 192 cameras that are, and by the way, at this, there are multiple cameras at numerous station platforms, but that there are a total of 192, and over the next several years, working with both the Department of Homeland Security, because here we are seeing a blending of issues that are around terrorist-type security matters, as well as crime, criminal type of activity that blends itself very well. And that is to be able to have, and I'm going to show you some scenes of that have been taken from our videos soon, just to give you a flavor of what's there. More than one-third of the light rail stations do have cameras. And that we will be, as we are installing new lines, as the green line construction, that is, from Gateway down to Clackamas Town Center and along the mall, we are also installing additional cameras. But as the mayor indicated, and I think the chief from Gresham, the line on the east side was built in 19, or completed and opened in 1986. In the intervening 21 years, we've learned a lot about what is appropriate. We would very candidly not build the current west or east side light rail as it is built today. That is, if you think about it from about Lloyd Center onto Gateway, it's down in that I-84 gully. It means that the platforms at the Hollywood station at about 42nd, at the 60th Street station, and at 82nd are below the street level. It means that there are not eyes on the street on those platforms. It means that the ability to be able to be on those platforms and either being rowdy, which certainly is a concern, even if not illegal behavior, or, in fact, encouraging actual illegal behavior. We know that, as we have found on the interstate max alignment, as we have found on the west side and so on, the eyes of the community on a platform is absolutely key to be able to ensure that there is less activity that occurs there. Next, I want to talk a moment about the additional security. We have 36 budgeted officers that are assigned to the Transit Police Division. We are currently at 29 today. On last Friday, an additional, the 28th up to 29, was assigned to us by Multnomah County. We will have another Multnomah County Deputy Sheriff assigned on November 30th. What's been at issue is, and as I understand, Beaverton has chosen not to be able to continue to participate with assigned officers. Again, from TriMet's standpoint, we do not have the ability to swear officers. We need to be able to have them assigned to us, which we pay full cost. There are a number of jurisdictions who are interested in assigning officers. Troutdale, Milwaukee, although they have an officer, to be able to assign an additional officer. The Port of Portland actually is interested, not a jurisdiction in a strict sense, but also is looking toward assigning their officers, an officer to us, as well as others. We need to be able to have those officers assigned, not holding out certain positions to be reserved for, in this case, the city of Beaverton. We need to be able to have a full complement. But we also think that our Wackenhut authority, these are the individuals who are neither armed nor authorized to be able to actually enforce the TriMet code, but can certainly by their very presence be able to be deterring actions that I think we'd all find to be able to be troubling on the system. We currently have 21 Wackenhut individuals who have been on the system, and I committed as a part of my 6-point plan to increase that by 15 additional Wackenhut individuals. We are doing that first by adding 6 additional officers and then making up the difference of those 9 additional that I want to be able to see by assigning overtime to be able to have the full-time equivalent of 15 officers until Wackenhut individuals. Until, in fact, we can recruit and have trained those additional bodies. We ran on this last weekend really an intense sweep at both or at all three of the 60th Street platform, the 82nd platform, and at Gateway. And from 6 a.m. in the morning until 2 a.m. the next morning, we had both our fare inspectors, 18 of them budgeted and all filled positions, along with Wackenhut, checking fares. We do believe very strongly that the integrity of the system has to be able to be built off of our people properly paying their fares. And I think we all know, we certainly recognize that with an open system, that is a challenge. Part of why I think we want to be able to look at, is there a pilot that ought to be utilized to be able to look at hardening a platform, but also how do we have additional presence? With that, with the concurrence of the chairs, I'd like to be able to show just very quickly 4 videos that might give you some sense. Let me stress here that although we've been talking about cameras that are actually on the platforms, all of our light rail vehicles have video on the video cameras on them. In fact, the police utilize that whenever there is an incident. They actually end up pulling that those tapes and asking us to be able to use them. They oftentimes are available as a way to be able to ensure that if they are not sure who the perpetrator is, that they can use it to identify. Obviously, in the very sad and heinous crime on Saturday night, that is the attack with a baseball bat on Mr. Chilcote, the individual didn't attempt to even escape, walked away, but wasn't trying to be able to escape and was able to be apprehended. Those cameras, though not working on that Saturday night, on the platform, are working. Now they were up on that Thursday. So let me go first to slides are in. What you'll see here is the
kidnapping.
This is, you may remember back in the news, the attempted kidnapping. That is, an individual jumped off a train. There were individuals visiting from outside of the area. They had their child in a stroller, the individual jumped off the train and moved forward.
The guy in the lower corner.
See the individual in the corner. And by the way, I'm going to point out one other thing here just when we've got this scene up. When we show this, these are four different cameras that are, in fact, on the light rail. And you see it right here. This is the camera. You'll see it in all four. By the nature of how we have to show this, we will show you all four, even though in a future one here you'll see that it's really only one panel that we're really looking at. But those are where the cameras are. They're constantly recording and are able to be used as a way to be able to deal with evidence. So the individual here moves forward. By the way, this is choppy because we do not record as a movie would. We actually have a little bit less than a second between frames, but it gives you a good sense of what's happening.
Skipping ahead a little bit because there's a little bit of time. There.
Okay.
Sorry. There he is right up there on the top.
On the top there, you will see.
And then skips and moves down, has a seat.
Right. Takes off his coat.
Which is going to happen, right?
Takes off his coat right there, and then prepares to be able to jump off of the train, which we're just about to.
Let's see, where'd he go? Sorry.
There, no?
No, not yet. Yep.
You'll see him moving off to the right with his coat off. Let me make sure we get jumped forward a little bit here. Now, in this case, by the way, the tape was to be able was valuable to the police because they were both able to identify the individual, although they caught him because another passenger, tackled him. But it was clear that he was on the train and using this as a way to be able to try to hide his coat. So it at least appeared that he probably was using it as a way to be able to camouflage who he was by taking off that coat. Although it was quite clear this individual was mentally ill, who knows for sure what all the motivations were that were here.
So he runs off, right? There he goes. That's him right there.
Okay.
You see him, in the top
see him
corner,
jumping off.
And then he moves off in the upper left-hand corner where the kid is.
And what you're seeing, by the way, is just so you know, although you can't see really through the glass because he has jumped off, grabbed the individual or the child out of the stroller, and then is tackled by another individual.
And that's the child in the upper right hand, standing there next to an empty stroller, you'll see, as it moves away.
Mm. Right there. So, anyway, a sense of how this works for our police. Let me turn to the next one. This is the event on last Saturday night. That is the attack on Mr. Chilcote.
The guy that kicks out the window.
Oh, okay. Here is an individual that you'll see in a second here in the black jacket. He is... Let's get to him right here.
Upper left hand.
With a backpack on. He is coming by. He's a panhandler. He is coming through and asking people for contributions. And what you'll see here is he comes up here and is asking these individuals. An individual right there on the top left corner gave him something. It appears from the interviews the police did that it was a cross, not money. He gets this, and you will see that he obviously is not pleased with this. In the upper left-hand corner.
Ooh.
Now, he does not hit the individual. He does punch out the glass, but you could imagine if you were sitting there and this happened anywhere near you, absolutely scary and intimidating. He was, because there were police very nearby, as he exits, he is actually arrested, but it also is used as a way to be able to enforce against that that individual for both damaging property, which ups the crime, and you'll see here that he's just about ready to exit on that upper right panel. Why don't we go ahead and skip forward? I don't want to take too much time from the...
That's the end of it.
Okay.
And the last four pictures are the
right. This is the attack on Chillcote. And if you remember in the news, the Gresham police released and the media showed two individuals that they felt were witnesses, is how they referred to them. They were individuals who were along with Mr. Garcia, who was in fact charged, as I understand it, being arraigned this afternoon for the attack. The two individuals are, let's go forward a little bit.
Mr. Chillcote's down there on the bottom. You can see his face.
On the,
left.
Right. Here is Lori Chillcote, just on the bottom left screen.
It's a baseball bat. You can see it.
Here, it's hard to be able to see, but it's a baseball bat under his jacket on the left, just above Mr. Chillcote's head.
And the other guy is right there behind him.
Right. That is the perpetrator that's right there behind. The individual that you're seeing is one of the two individuals who the police wanted to interview and the woman as well, to be able to understand better. They were not charged, or at least it appears that they are not going to be charged with it, but you can see how valuable this was to be able to help identify the actual individuals of police. This happens all the time, that is, that the police call for what is called data packs and use that as a way to be able to help enforce. With that, let me close by once again stressing that the commitment that I made as general manager, as well as the whole of the TriMet team, is that we want to be able to ensure that every rider or prospective rider feels safe to be able to ride the system. We are not there by any means at this stage. We need to be able to find ways to be able to additional partner, to be able to put in different strategies in place to be able to achieve that. And my commitment is to be able to work with the partners throughout the whole of the Portland region to ensure that that happens. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hampton. I do have a few, an observation and maybe a comment. And I appreciate the video and the fact that the trains do have the video there, and also on the platforms. One of the issues there, though, and I think, and as you look forward to trying to find solutions to this, is especially on the platforms, is that this is good for investigation of crimes that have happened, but it does, and for some people that may be prevention, but notice by some of these incidents, those are not deterrents. And I think that particularly on the platforms, to look at some issues where these actually may be monitored. I think a lot of people, when they think of cameras, they think somebody's watching, and no one is correct. There is no real-time monitoring of platform. This is all take the tape and find out what happened.
Certainly there are feeds from directly into our dispatch center at Ruby Junction from a number of the platform cameras, but those that are on the vehicles themselves are, in fact, data packs must be pulled, and then are after-the-fact reviewed.
But is anyone actively monitoring the ones that are fed into Ruby Station?
The answer is no, and very frankly, this is something that that not only security systems that are transit-oriented, but others have found, that it is the monotony that's associated with it has been such that it is very difficult to be able to keep people engaged and actually see things that actually happen. More and more technology is being developed that will, in fact, for example, have ways to be able to spot very quick movement, something that might be intimidating, and then that screen gets triggered. There are other items that appear to be promising, but very frankly, this is something that is more after the fact than it is the active monitoring to be able to immediately step in. And again, as I say, this is something not only we, but most systems that actually have these types of monitoring have been very difficult to be able to have the human mind be able to focus on hour after hour or minute after minute.
Well, one thing I would encourage you to look at, because and I have seen this, especially in some high-tech facilities where security is a real issue, because you are right, and with technology, and I'm not an expert on this, so I'm just giving the 40,000-foot view. I'm not going to try to get into details about this, but I have seen these systems, and you're right about the monotony, but they can be programmed to us where movements that are not typical, you know, immediately identify, and so that someone who is there and the camera recognizes unusual activity through all kinds of real high-tech stuff that I don't understand that can bring attention to it, you know, and that is one thing to look at. I think the other thing, too, is I'd be interested in your comments first about Fairless Square. I've never been a fan of Fairless Square, although at least in that particular area, the closer you get to the city hub, of course, you have more concentration of people. So there's another issue there, but it also is where a lot of your, you know, the people, you know, are deployed, and you know, there's a lot of eyes and ears there. But I'd be curious about your thoughts about a Fairless Square, and then also about revisiting the system that we have for, you know, collecting fares. And there's issues involved there, but clearly the I don't think it takes a rocket science to understand that certainly amongst certain populations that paying the fare is not a routine expectation, and not necessarily going to activities or to work or the things that for basic commuting. And I think that, you know, if you have a fare, it's paid. If you have, you know, a fair pay, you know, I think you're likely to get more fair play. I mean, I'm a poet. You know, and this may be a bad analogy, but you know, in transportation, we've had some great presentations, and Jim Whitty will be making a presentation later, and we'll probably talk about something like that. But when we talk about congestion, and you're on the highway, and you can't move, and you look at some of the models, and that removing just 10% of the cars actually solves 50% of the, you know, congestion, you know, so it's not a one-for-one reaction. You get a lot of bang out of minimal changes to a system. And I think the same thing would bear out with, you know, collecting fares. When people actually are there because they have to pay, because they actually have to have a reason to board, I think a lot of the other costs, and I know there's tremendous costs involved in security, over time can really pay for itself if it's addressed up front in the appropriate way. And so that those who would, you know, use this conduit of crime for that purpose, when some of those incentives are no longer there, then those who want to use the system for commuting, you know, become the dominant force. I think down the road, you can have a situation where security is much greater. And I know you don't want, and I wouldn't certainly want a fortress mentality, and I don't think you want just people in blue uniforms on trains. I mean, that's, but it may be necessary short term. To change the modality of, you know, of how these trains operate and who utilizes them. But looking, I think, really at the environmental security, mm-hmm. that would be the long-standing approach, an investment that might be a lot more upfront than we currently are looking at, but for the long-term health of the system and the ability to expand and its acceptance and everything else that it does great for our community. And, you know, we have the light rail that's going into Clackamas Town. Mm-hmm. We've just authorized bonds for Milwaukee. And I would be curious as to your thoughts, A, particularly about the fare issue, about how we might address this, and what your view is on that and how it may relate to some of the incidents that we're seeing. And number two, are you intending in these discussions to think about going back to the drawing board before we build Clackamas Light Rail or before we build Milwaukee Light Rail, and changing some of the priorities so that these new stations are designed in such a manner in which fare collection becomes part of the environmental design, and we don't have to continue to throw human and other resources at the same level to maintain security?
Chair Metzger, let me come back specifically to the last question and then hit some of the other ones. The answer is we are open at looking at all ways of being able to make the system work. I do think that we have to be able to recognize that there are parts of the system that are going to make that very difficult. Pioneer Square, again, an example. But that doesn't mean that some of the outline platforms cannot, in fact, be hardened to really have the kind of turnstile or other sort of thing that is there. Let me go back and reiterate the point that you made, though, about fares in general. We believe very strongly that the integrity of the system is what's at issue in terms of appropriate fare collection. That is, for the person who pays, and about, by the way, about half of our people who are riding have some form of a monthly pass. And so even though if you're on the platform and you don't see somebody buying a ticket that trip, about half of the people who are using the system do have a monthly pass that they purchase, so you wouldn't, that wouldn't be the test. But the integrity of the system is equally important for people who don't pay, that is, they are held accountable. Second, for people who have paid, that they feel that they haven't just been taken advantage of. And I think that the goal that I have is that that integrity of the system must be had and must be addressed. Back to Fairless Square in the downtown Portland area. Certainly our police force and others have noted that that's one of the biggest problems that they think encourages some of the activity that's on. It's an icon, however, as we know, for this region, that there isn't a travel magazine that writes about coming here that doesn't talk generally about the Fairless system. But to be able to have that dialogue, I think, is very important. One of the challenges we have is that when people get on in Fairless, but to be able to move beyond Fairless, it is difficult because you've got people who are, you know, that there isn't that issue at the time they actually board. Lastly, let me mention that I do believe that the technology that's associated with fare collection is really, if not quite the 19th century, pretty early or mid-20th century. It is certainly not 21st century technologies. And the fare collection industry, I think, is looking much more at ways that, in fact, electronics can assist in that. You know, if somebody's walking out with a piece of shoplifted merchandise from a store, there are beepers. Something goes off. That technology has not yet been developed on a fare system, but I don't think it's that far away either. And so I think that we're going to be watching very closely the technology side of this equation and not just think that it's a human resource issue, because I think we all know that almost no matter how much resource we throw at it, one, it's very expensive, and it's very hard to be able to maintain in terms of the overall costs.
Representative
Byer. Well, more just a comment coming from the Eugene Springfield area where we have our bus rapid transit system, which is working very well. It's fareless. We're on the first leg of it, and the technology to use a fare on these buses depends on masses of riders. So we're looking out towards at least the second route that they put on before they can even make the investment in the type of fares or fare collection that they need to. So, and I'm assuming that's really not an issue with TriMet. I mean, you have quite a system there. So is it just catching up with is there not any type of technology available?
Well, what's at issue is, on the TriMet system right now, the system, Chair Metzger referred to it as a honor system, it's really a proof of payment system. That is, an individual is expected to be able to have and is in fact required to be able to produce that if there is a fare inspector, a police officer, or others to be able to say, here, you're not in Fairless Square anymore, show me your proof. And if they don't, they're able to, in fact, one of the things the police think is very important is they're able to engage that individual, ask for their identification. Oftentimes in that process, find out that having nothing to do with the TriMet system, that they have outstanding warrants and may, in fact, be arrested for those outstanding warrants. Not for the activity on the system, but it's kind of that broken taillight, that is, it allows for a police officer to engage. Now, having said that, the honor system, the proof of purchase, proof of payment, is one that is able to be engaged if asked. But if not, there isn't a technology that says, you've walked through those doors. If you don't have a ticket that can be read by infrared or other mechanism, it doesn't send off the beep. That's the technology that is beginning to be talked about in the transit industry as a whole. I think that type of technology will be very, very important because more and more systems are copying the Oregon system, the Portland system, and region system, and in fact using platforms that are in fact shared as a part of the streetscape.
Representative Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, we're going to have a lot of assurance about safety before TriMet comes in, or MAX comes into Milwaukee, and we'll have those further conversations. But I have a couple of questions. One of them was we talked about the cameras at either the MAX stations or on the MAX line. So the incident that happened last Saturday, there was a camera that wasn't working. So what happened there, and is that a common problem?
The camera was in the process at the Gresham Central Station, was in the process of being installed. The final wiring was not, in fact, connected on Saturday, November 3rd, which was when the attack occurred on Mr. Shillcoat, Lori Shillcoat. It was by Wednesday, I believe, of that following week, in the normal process, it was, in fact, up and operating, and the feeds are there. It was most unfortunate, although in this case, oftentimes that camera would have, in fact, helped identify the assailant. As we found in this case, the individual wasn't trying to be able to escape, wasn't trying to hide what he did, and, in fact, was arrested within minutes of the attack. But that's not to say that we wouldn't have wanted those cameras up, but as I think you know, that it's a very difficult, Representative Tomei, to be able to, you know, we can look back and say, why wasn't it two more days earlier? I mean, obviously, I'm very troubled by the fact that we could have had that. Fortunately, in that case, it didn't make any difference. But the on-train, as you saw here, helped identify the two witnesses that the police did want to be able to talk to, which were not able to be identified otherwise, but by those photographs that the Gresham Police, after they asked for our tape, released to the media, and I do not know, the Gresham Police Chief would have to tell you whether they've actually talked to those individuals.
I have a couple of follow-ups. Thank you. So are the cameras a deterrent at all? Do the people who ride MAX know that there are cameras there? And if not, would it be possible to have signs or whatever that are being photographed?
Actually, there are some that signs up right now that indicate that. Do people notice it, and do they deter behavior? Certainly, for any individual who is not wanting to be caught, one would hope that they would figure out that they may in fact be recorded and do it. In the case of the attack on Saturday night, it was quite clear that that individual did not care about it. Now, I would add that we use not just for security reasons, but we have actually had situations for claims where people have jumped on a bus after an accident, claimed injuries, and we have been able to, in fact, prosecute individuals for trying to be able to extort claim money out of us. So it's used for a series of different things, not just the crime side of that. Are they aware? You would think that anybody who jumped on a bus thinking they could claim that they were on the bus at the time of an accident or a hard stop would be a little smarter, but some of these people are not.
One of the things that I've heard, if I may, is that when people, if discovered they don't have a ticket, they get off, but they just get on the next MAX. Is that a problem?
I am sure it is. Certainly, we will see when our fare inspectors come on a train that they see people starting to exit. My guess is, and I've heard it when I'm riding the system, that somebody says, I hear there's a fare inspector up there, better get off at this station and move. What I want us to be able to do is to have both random enough as well as consistent enough coverage that, you know, that isn't going to get you very far, meaning that you're not not going to be able to use the system. Just wait for one more train until you get going. But I don't want to kid anybody that it's going to be that every single train that goes by, you know, they're about every 3 or 4 minutes in rush hour, is going to be able to have that presence. But we want to have substantially more presence than we do, and to be able to be ensuring that the integrity of the system, the fare collection system, is there, and that people then finally decide it's not worth it. One thing that our police do tell us, though, is that people who are involved in, for example, drug dealing, they do not take a chance on not having their fare, because what they don't want is to be able to be engaged by that police officer, found that they actually have drugs or outstanding warrants. They've gotten savvy on that and are fare paying.
And one last question, if I may. So are there panic buttons either on the MAX itself or at the station if someone does feel like they're in danger?
On the MAX system, there is a button at each door where it, in fact, connects with the operator of that system, where anybody can report something that's going on that's there. Now, I don't want to mislead you, though. Very frankly, if there is either obnoxious or a very intimidating behavior nearby, I don't think it's reasonable to assume that somebody is going to get on and kind of invite those very individuals to be able to take retaliatory action. But it is there on the MAX system. At the platforms themselves, there is not. Generally speaking, with the proliferation of cell phones, 911 is the most effective call to that. But our operator is immediately, if there's a problem, will in fact connect with our dispatch, and there is a priority. If the dispatch sends that to 911, there is a priority box into which calls from a TriMet operator for assistance is actually put. I'm not going to be able to tell you from 911 standpoint exactly how that all works, but it is a priority if there is a call from an operator.
And I really look forward to talking with you, Warren, and other people before we put MAX into Milwaukee.
Absolutely.
Making sure that it's safe for all of our residents and that they're perceiving it as being safe.
Well, and let me say that there are relatively few actual crimes on the system itself. I think the point that Mayor Bemis has made really is don't be quite so narrow in your definition, and I think we historically have, partly because how the transit police system grew up. But I think this discussion, this focus of this region is saying we've got to be much more comprehensive. We TriMet, but also the partners to be able to address that broader issue of what happens, not just at the platforms, but, you know, a ways off. How do we really partner to be able to address those issues more effectively?
Thank you.
And that's a good point, because, again, we don't want it to be a magnet for crime, even if it's not on this session itself. Senator Berger.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. The police today talked about this ongoing problem that they've been making reports to you. So you've been very aware of how many service calls that have been made. And then on television, after this brutal beating, they interviewed different people who said that everyone seemed to be aware of the kind of situation. Do you think that you've been putting together your six-point plan and your summit and all that? Do you feel that it's unfair to say you've been slow to respond, or do you think your response to what you already knew has been acceptable?
Well, certainly from our standpoint, we have done up to the attack on Saturday night, have focused what historically we have with our transit police, and that's really the activity on the line itself, in the trains themselves, on the platforms, but really stopping at that platform. The issue that I think that Mayor Bemis has raised, and I think that you're hearing echoed today from the chiefs in both Gresham and Hillsborough, is we need to be able to find a different model. That definition is not so narrow. We recognize that when there is an event, an incident that's off several blocks off from the system, that we need to be able to be a part of that. In fact, on Monday of this week is a very good example of the type of thing. At 122nd, just off Burnside, there was a report coming into the police 911 number that there was a young male with a gun. The that description of the individual went out on the system, and within about 10 or so minutes, one of our transit police officers saw an individual matching the description nearby a bus stop, not at the MAC station, but close, probably three blocks away. He then approached that individual, and as he came up to start talking to them, the individual took off running. The transit police officer, followed that individual and added to the chase. The individual then began waving a gun, which that transit police officer immediately backs off, which is the standard protocol, and they establish a perimeter looking for that individual. In this case, they did not find the individual, but they did find the gun that had been discarded. Now, here's an incident that has nothing to do with the transit. It did not appear that he'd either been on transit or was intending to go to transit, but it was happening very close. One of our transit police officers actually responded to it. It's that kind of partnership that needs to be done both directions. That is, both our transit police responding to incidents that have nothing to do with us, likewise other jurisdictions. And the question is, how do we integrate those so that we really get more than just 1 + 1 = 2?
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Would you elaborate a little bit on the summit? The safety summit that you plan on having, who is going to be participating?
We are really, in fact, utilizing much of the role or the approach that was taken by Mayor Bemis in calling the safety summit back in March. That is, elected officials, we would expect that the mayors, in fact, have tried to coordinate with their schedules for the jurisdictions, county chair of Washington County, as well as the police chiefs from the various jurisdictions as well. That is the beginning backbone, but we expect that there will be many other people who want to be able to play a role, everything from the gang response teams, others. We understand that there are many players in this, and we want to be able to find that partnership.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that we're pressed for time, but I did ask a question regarding why it was that we felt like that we could avoid the problems that we didn't need the safety and security issues that other metropolitan areas have included. My first question is, Mr. Hansen, why was it that back in 1985, or perhaps no one else had these problems back in 85 when our system went into effect, did we not have better security and better panic buttons?
Well, two things, Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, and that is, first is that when this system was designed, it was unique within the nation. That is, a part of a system that was a part of the streetscape. And although not all our platforms were that, certainly the ones along I-84 at Hollywood 60th and 82nd were not. But it was really to be able to make it in the downtown core area really a part of that streetscape. And that was a very conscious decision about how this system should work. It was not looked at as something that should be underground or to be able to be set off from the community as a whole. And I think that that system worked very well for a number of years. But now I think that the sheer magnitude of the people who are writing it, that is that 50,000 people, a small city, means that the types of problems that come with a larger city, are things that plague our system as well as others. And I think it's really this effort that we're rethinking, how do we want to think about that, and how do we best approach it? Are we willing to really abandon those principles? And my guess is probably not, but we want to modify them to be able to be better. What are some of the other tools we can use to make what's unique here and has, I think, been very, very popular? Our ridership is increasing dramatically every year. We are 29th in population for the type of transit system we have, and yet nationwide we rank number 11 in total riders. How do we really build on that, not throw away things that are very good, but also ensure that we have that kind of security that we all want?
Follow up, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second question I had was with regard to the honor system itself. Number one, we've heard testimony today that, you know, offering to go ahead and clean out the train for those who did not have tickets as many as 70% of the passengers left. One of the concerns that you expressed was that, hey, 50% of the folks that are riding on a regular basis already have monthly tickets, so we know that they probably weren't the folks that jumped off. Number one, do we know what percentage actually ride the MAX who have tickets? And second of all, who else uses in nationwide this honor system?
First off is, in terms of the percentage, the surveys we've done have indicated that right around 8% are actually fare evading. Now, that's throughout the whole system, both bus and rail, and I think we recognize that the rail side probably has a higher percentage, and I don't have that off the top of my head, although my guess is that we have that number. But I don't think any of us think that that is necessarily answering the full question. That is, do people take one additional stop if they're coming out of downtown Portland, heading west? PGE Park technically is back in the fare system. Do people go from the Galleria just that one additional stop and walk to a restaurant or to home without paying? My guess is they do. So the issue, I think, is are we really, in fact, getting those fares collected? And I believe that that's a part of what this effort is how do we really find ways to be able to make that system work better and to have integrity within it?
Just one final comment. I'm going to guess that all of the local municipalities probably already have arrangements where their officers can come and go while they're in uniform. Do officers who are commuting to and from work in uniform ride free?
They, if they're a part of the transit police, the answer is yes. But part of the issue that I think Mayor Bemis indicated is how do we really get officers out of their cars and to be on the system? Ours isn't that the fare is the blockage. It is how do we get them actually out there? We want that presence to be very visible. And I think all of us who ride the system recognize that when you see a blue uniform or brown, if it's in the case of Multnomah County or the other jurisdictions, it's very welcome to be able to see that. We want more and more of officers to be able to do that. Beaverton, others have in fact used that as just a way to be able to transit back and forth from where they're doing other sweeps. And to us, that makes a lot of sense. It's a part of the partnership we need to expand to others because, very frankly, anytime people are on the system and see that, we think it's very important.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Okay, Mr. Hansen, thank you for coming. Just a couple of observations as we kind of move forward. Number one is statistics. You know, statistics are really important because I think they help us really get a sense of reality. Sometimes we don't like to look at them that way, but in terms of actually trying to make improvements in anything, we have to be kind of honest about the information there. And I appreciate that. And certainly with some data we've had from TriMet, going back to our previous discussion on crossing safety and then we look at data from Gresham and Hillsborough, and we get a lot different picture of it. And so, number one, I would, and I know you'll be responsive to this, is to really take seriously working well with all of our partners so that we have a real picture of what the issues that we have, so we have a way to measure the impacts of what we end up doing. I think that's a real important thing. And I also think it's really important to the public, as you know, and my background in media is that, you know, the worst costs of all is having the papers and the TV plastered with incidents about your business, because then you have to put a bunch of resources in that you would could use somewhere else, and not having the incidents in the first place is certainly a best use of resources. I also observed that just looking in the Gresham statistics, and I don't think surprisingly, but they're totally dominated by incidents after 1700 hours. I mean, so, you know, also looking at the time in which some of these things are dominant, I think is important. And finally, we're in a unique partnership now because of the major commitment the legislature did. Now it is a state issue with TriMet with the $250 million for rail for Milwaukee Light Rail. And I think it's really important. I think everybody is, I know the city of Gresham, Hillsborough, even though Beaverton's not here, and yourself, are all committed to really getting our hands around this and solving an issue as we expand a system that is so important to our whole metro community. But we have to make sure that we follow through, and not just not for you, but for all of us, and that includes those of us who are policymakers, to make sure we follow through for the results and can measure the impact of that. And I did speak with Legislative Fiscal extensively about this issue, and I know the operating agreement has been put in place, but it's going to be quite a while before we will allow the bonds to be issued. And it is, in talking with Fiscal, made it pretty clear that I don't think we intend to allow the bonds to be issued for the next phase of light rail until we have real comfort that we're moving forward on this. So what I would ask you to do is, we will be in session in 3 months, as you know, in February, and would ask that, and we'll bring you and others back as well, to look at the information that you've compiled in your meetings and other, and bring to us what your plan is, what you observed, what your immediate action steps have been, what your long-term plan is, not only for the existing system, but what are milestones, benchmarks that you've established as we continue to grow the system, both in Clackamas and Milwaukee, to try and, whether it's through environmental design or others, try to address these issues so that we can get a good grasp of what's been done, what you learned, what's been done, and then what are plans going forward or other studies that need to be done that will lead to results. And if you would be so kind as to then come back to us in February.
Absolutely.
With that report, that would I think that would give everybody and certainly the public a real confidence that not only are we talking about the issue today, we're talking about streetscapes, but no one wants to be part of a streetscape, like Mr. Chilcote. So it's really important that the public have a real sense of not only is this something that was in the paper today and gone tomorrow, but that we have follow-through, that we have a system that we're proud of, we're making changes to address not only the system, but the benefits to our community so that we can continue to gather the support that we need to build a great system. And I appreciate you taking the time, and I appreciate the committee interest in the issue, and we'll look forward to a report in February.
I'll see you in February.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we're going to close that informational hearing, and thank you, members, very, very much. I think this is a real important issue because of our, it's a historic partnership that we made with TriMet this last session, and we want to make sure that accountability in the system and everybody feels comfortable about what we're doing going forward. I'm going to turn the gavel over the rest of the meeting to Chairwoman Beyer, and thank you again for taking the time.
I'm going to open a public hearing on the DMV performance benchmarks, and Tom McClellan has come forward.
While he's getting ready, Chair Metzger, Chair Beyer, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm with the Oregon DMV. I'm the acting administrator of the Oregon DMV. I was asked to give a report on a study that was recently done on benchmarking of our DMV compared to 8 other jurisdictions in Canada and the United States. I gave this presentation to the Oregon Transportation Commission last month and then was asked to share this information with you as well. So I know you're short for time. I'll try to move as quickly as possible through this. The written testimony summarizes the key points of these slides, and I'll just quickly go through these. Like I said, there are 9 jurisdictions involved in this study. It's the third year we've done this. The Virginia, a commissioner with the Virginia DMV contacted me about 3 years ago and asked about doing this, and we've done it 3 times. It's a detailed survey containing hundreds of financial transactions, service data, revenue information, very data intensive, and then a comparison is done across the jurisdictions by standardizing that data. We get an annual report, plus we also receive what's called a best practices review as part of this contract. Earlier reports were on renewal notices for driver licensing and vehicle registration, websites the DMVs have had in the past, and customer call center is a report that we just received. Uh, Overall, the results were quite good for our agency. Cost-wise, we compared quite well with the other jurisdictions at $28 per licensed driver. That was right at the peer median. We have excellent customer service levels. Two examples would be our field office wait times on an annual average basis has been 12 minutes. The peers in this study were 19 minutes. Telephone wait times, the peers were 273 seconds for a customer to wait. We've been at 44 seconds. We now have a new phone system in place, and it's calculating the wait times a little bit differently. We're closer to the 90 to 100 seconds at the moment, which is still far better than what the other jurisdictions were. But it's excellent service to those people who call in. Our 296 employees per million drivers is well below the peer average of 404 employees per million drivers. So it's an efficiency measure for us. We've sorted the jurisdictions by size in this table. As you can see, Oregon is one of the smaller states involved, with 4 million registered vehicles and approximately 3 million licensed drivers. It's significantly smaller than the average of the other jurisdictions. When you have California and Florida involved, they're much bigger, obviously. Maryland and South Carolina are the most comparable to us. We do have a bit of an economy of scale, a disadvantage in this study because of our size being much smaller than the others. A few summary statistics from this chart. Approximately 62% of all the costs that we incur are from driver licensing and vehicle titling and registration. About 84% of our revenue is just from the vehicle title and registration process alone. And about 67%, two-thirds of our revenue goes to cities and counties and the state highway fund. So we're collecting far more than it costs to operate our agency. The one area that stands out probably the most to me as I look at this is the driver monitoring, where the costs exceed the revenues. Driver monitoring is a category that includes monitoring driving records, medical reviews, managing court orders, and the whole process around issuing restrictions, suspensions, revocations, and reinstatements on driver licensing. We're going to be taking a look at why those costs are so much higher than revenues, but also compared to other states. On this chart, it's showing that the total costs range from a low of $13.70 per licensed driver to about $52. For confidential reasons, we don't know what these other states are. We are assuming that the larger states are the lower cost ones because of those economies of scale. We were told that Washington, D.C. was the highest one on the chart, which is by far the smallest. Costs are impacted by a number of and types of things, the types of services you provide, and the delivery channels in particular, as well as the number and types of transactions per licensed driver. Online services can reduce your costs. Mail services are less than field services, field being the most expensive way to deliver services to the public. Oregon's total revenue of $85.22 per licensed driver was equal to the peer median in the study. Revenue is a little more difficult to compare across jurisdictions because the statutes are so different across jurisdictions. For confidential reasons, of course, we don't know what the other states were, but I guess it's safe to say we're right in the middle as far as the nine jurisdictions that were involved. Here are a few kind of key metrics that we've looked at. One, it's interesting to note, I guess, that Oregon has nearly twice as many picture license locations per million licensed drivers compared to the peer jurisdiction average at 21.7 compared to 12. That's more field offices around the state than most of these other jurisdictions in the study. Our average wait time for customer service in field offices and on the telephone, again, is significantly less than our peer average. The service scores were developed by the consultant, by the contractor, measures of levels of service, looking at different types of delivery channels. It's weighted by their view of what the importance would be. So it's not really based on survey work, but it's their perception of what is most important. We score again, quite well in each of these categories. The one area that we are lower than the peer average is the licensed agent category. And the primary reason for this is because the DEQ emissions testing stations, snow part permit agents, and third-party CDL testers are considered licensed agents for this study, and they provide very limited services, very specific and limited, not a full range of DMV services, and they do not do customer satisfaction surveys as part of their work. Of note is our service score for the telephone transactions is the best of all the jurisdictions in this study.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I just had one quick question. Mr. McClellan, who selected the other eight jurisdictions? Was that the contractor?
It was self-selection. All the states and even Canadian provinces were asked to participate, and these were the ones that agreed to pay. It's about $30,000 a year to do the study, but also cared enough to do this kind of benchmarking work to engage the consultant.
So, if I may then, Madam Chair, just to follow up, then Oregon chose to participate. States of similar size, such as Colorado or other western states other than California, which we know is one of the world's largest economies, really, we don't have anything to compare to in the western United States other than California.
That's true.
Okay,
that's true.
Thank you.
They've tried to standardize these services by per million, per thousand licensees, per vehicle things, but it is very difficult to compare. That's one of the reasons why we will probably not renew this contract. We've done it 3 years. The results have been very similar each year. We've been disappointed that more jurisdictions have not participated. This particular company has been very active in the public retirement systems across the country. Most of the state public retirement systems participate in similar studies, and their results, I think, are much more meaningful because there's a higher percentage of them involved. So we've been very disappointed that they haven't been able to get more states to join up.
Yeah, I would express that disappointment, too, because when you're comparing the state of Oregon versus Ontario, Canada, the province of Ontario, that's got to be worlds apart so far as all of those things are concerned. I mean, when you're talking about cost per million drivers, when Oregon has probably less than 2 million drivers, I would think, total.
I think we have 4 million.
Do we have 4 million? Wait a minute. How could we have 4 million Oregon drivers?
4 million cars.
3 million licensed drivers.
Out of 3.5 million people?
And people living military, temporarily out of the state, could have a driver's license.
Those would be counted in our census, then, I'm assuming, if they're living temporarily out of the state. Not many children under 12 years of age. I mean, I know that the schools tell us that they've got K-12, something in the vicinity of 500,000 to 600,000. So virtually every other person than those K-12 would have to have at least one driver's license at that point. So I'm questioning the numbers at that point.
That's right. And I guess I have a quick question related to that. And these are licensed drivers, or do they include ID?
Permit holders, but not ID.
Not ID. Okay.
So driver permits and license holders, suspended and valid licenses, the total. The last slide is just a summary. Our operating costs compare well against the jurisdictions that were in this study, despite our smaller size. Service levels are excellent. We've long maintained that we're one of the best-kept secrets in Oregon state government, and despite the derogatory jokes on late-night TV about DMVs, that we actually think we do a pretty good job in serving Oregonians. Our field office wait times are excellent. Telephone wait times are also quite good. We provide high-quality customer service while keeping our costs down. So we're quite proud of the work that we do, and it's nice to see that an outside study, an outside consultant, found the same thing. So that concludes my report.
Senator Verger.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just am a little curious about your wait times and customer service. Is that the only thing that you
measure customer service by?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, we measure lots of things, lots of internal measures. These are just a few of the ones that are very customer-focused. We track title turnaround times, vehicle registration, how long it takes to issue those, entering convictions, and suspensions onto driving records. You name it, we've got it. Lots of measures, a lot of things are tracked. These were the ones that the consultants were trying to standardize across jurisdictions to see where there were major differences.
Thank you.
No other questions?
Great.
Thank you.
Well, thank you
very much.
Good
working with you.
Mr. Chair, they do an excellent job. I've just had some work done there, and they are quick, and they do a really good job.
I think I've heard that. I always try to go there. I try not to go to these, you know, the speedy service ones and stuff. I always want to be right in there at the DMV and see actually how they're treating people and how they're working.
So. We don't have a speedy service one in Gentura.
We actually have one in the Eugene area. So close the public hearing on that one, and I'm going to open a public hearing on the 2008 Oregon Traffic Safety Performance Plan. And Troy, thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair,
Mr. Chair,
Senators, Representatives. My name is Troy Costales, Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I come before you in a little bit of a different situation than most often. Generally with you, I'm talking about different subjects, different safety items that are out there. And today I get the chance to talk to you a little bit about how we go about making the choices that we make within the Safety Division and how we monitor how well we're doing. And so I'll take you through the 2008 Traffic Safety Performance Plan, which is the red document that you're receiving. Within highway safety, one of the most important parts about what we do is making sure that everybody understands what's going on. Similar to the discussions that you've had in the prior two conversations, is that communication is the key to make sure that everybody's on the same page, understands where you're heading. Because when it comes to highway safety, we are talking about a life and death situation as we're out on the public road system around the state.
Das hier ist mein Sektor. Das hier ist das wichtigste Gerät des Küstenwächters. Das Gerät und das Gerät. Überlebensradar.
Mayday, Mayday. Hello, can you hear us? Can you hear us? Can you get over? We are sinking.
Hello? This is the German Coast Guard.
We're sinking.
What are you thinking about?
So we do recognize in highway safety that sometimes the interpretation and the dialect and where we're heading on different things can get misinterpreted. And so we work real hard within the Highway Safety Office and within ODOT in general, making sure that when we do things around highway safety that we're doing the right thing and we're doing it well. State Highway Safety Office, to put a little bit in perspective of how Oregon operates. Across the country, there are three types of highway safety offices. This was created in the 1960s by Congressional Act, identifying a highway safety office that is to operate and bring together not only a grant program, but also state and community services related to highway safety. All of us, all highway safety offices, must do grants, deal with the data, and deal with federal dollars. That is the one thing that we have in common for all states and territories within the United States, across the board. However, only half of those highway safety offices actually get into the program level, where they are involved in providing training, where they are involved in doing media, where they are involved in making sure that there's analysis as to what are the problems that we should be working on. And then there's the third level, which only about 15%. If you think about it, that's only 8 or 9 in the entire country that actually get involved in policy conversation, get involved in legislative concepts, come forward to panels such as yours and talk about things that are going on, deal with governor committees. And in our case in Oregon, yes, we are in that last group and do all three of these things, very fortunately, in Oregon. And in our case, we do have three governor-appointed committees. And I'd like just to take a moment, Madam Chair. I happen to actually have three of the governor's Oregon Traffic Safety Committee members are here. They were meeting this morning and adjourned this afternoon to come over here. Vice Chair Marion Owens, who's from Glendale, is with us. Member Mike Lafferty from Depot Bay and Member Luis Ornelas from Portland were meeting today here in Salem and then came over to join you. Just happened to coincide at the same time.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
We do have three governor-appointed committees, as mentioned, on DUI and motorcycle safety as well. Within the highway safety program, there has been a change. One of the cornerstone pieces of running a highway safety office is dealing with the federal funds that flow to the state for purposes of doing traffic safety work. In the past, we used to have a situation where we competed based on laws or based on programs. All the states and territories, unbeknownst to each other, would put in their information. There was a big bucket of money in the sky, and based on how many states qualified and how big of a state you were, that's how much money you got. Well, if one year we had money and we were involved in a program and California wasn't a winner, we got a fair amount of money. But if the next year California stepped up and they changed the law or they became part of the program, guess what? Our fair share pretty much shrunk because California takes 10% of the whole pot with them qualifying. And so the competition, we always sit to scratch our head. And in front of you in the Ways and Means Committee, I would do the best I could to forecast who I thought was out there working on things that were going to qualify or not. And for the past decade, we've actually done a pretty good job. And we have qualified across the board for all the safety programs federally that have come into the state to put into play into programs all around the state. And the money that came in, for the most part, came to us for highway safety purposes. We, the collective we, all got to talk about what the priorities were. Was it DUI? Was it youth? Was it aggressive driving? Was it safety belts? We got to walk through and do that problem identification analysis and deal with the laws and move forward and talk about that money. However, we never knew whether our pot was going to grow or our pot was going to shrink as to how we were going to apply that. Hence, our annual business plan. This outlines for you all of the money, federal as well as state, that the safety division puts into play every year and where it's being spent all across the state. And then now the change. With Safety Lou, which is the Surface Transportation Act at the congressional level that funds transportation systems, highway safety is part of that. But now the highway safety programs come with a big catch. More and more and more, what is happening is the funds that are allocated by Congress and handed to the states are for a particular purpose, have a particular reason, have a particular place where they need to be played out, and you have less and less discretion at the state level and the highway safety level as to how we turn around and use those. The money is coming across very much in silos. And it becomes difficult because we also have an initiative of saying, what are our problems? Where are we heading? What are we trying to achieve? And so the work at the highway safety office becomes more and more difficult to try and move those forward. That's why the performance plan is so important, is so that when we do get those discretionary dollars that we can apply to the highest priority, we can mate those up with the programs that have dedicated dollars and make the best approach to saving lives and reducing injuries in the state that we can. This document covers programs such as the list that is there, but some things that typically aren't associated with highway safety that we have in Oregon that you, the legislature, have actually handed to us. We are responsible for driver education in this state. We are responsible for the motorcycle safety program and the training. We are responsible for safe routes. We are responsible for a bicycle safety program. All things that are forwarded either the responsibility of the safety committee or the division direct to try and do the best work we can based on what revenue does happen to flow our way, federal or state. This document goes through a particular structure for every one of these programs and making sure that their problems are outlined, that there is a goal and an expectation of performance measure. And this document has now served as a national model, and six states have transitioned to this exact format to show how their program is operating in relationship to the money and the expectations upon the programs that they run. The performance plan must have deliverable measures so that at the end of the year you can turn around and say, here's what we did or we did not do. And every December 31st, we do a report on the last year. And we tell you, and we tell everybody that asks, here's what we paid for, and here's what was delivered. And it is very integrated into our Ways and Means presentation that we make every biennium to you. We also look for examples around the state where we can take advantage of some things. Most recently, we had some work in Mount Hare County, where we had some individuals there that were very interested in doing something for highway safety, starting from a child safety clinic start seat type of an event, and have now sprung into some things that are countywide that are going on and being involved, where judges are involved, law enforcement is involved, firefighters, volunteer paramedics, and things such as the Trauma Nurses Talk Tough program that we take advantage of that is out there because there are trauma systems around the state in order to make a difference. And most recently, we started a multi-agency tactical team approach with law enforcement, getting law enforcement agencies to work collectively together, particularly right now on the whole issue of speeding. Because none of the agencies on their own necessarily always have enough resources for traffic teams to be able to do some things like you hear about, which we've been doing now for a couple decades, on DUI. Impaired driving, they do those tactical teams. Stretching that model into the speed area to try and make a difference in the aggressive driving and speeding issues that we unfortunately read too often, you know, people doing 100 plus, and unfortunately too many fatalities recently where speeding is the major causal factor in relationship to that death or that injury. We also in this document articulate how we're spending our money. You can pick this up, you can flip to any page, any topic in this book, and we tell you to the dollar what grants we are running that initiated on October 1st of this year. The performance plan creates also the sideboards. It also tells us what we're not going to do. Areas that we, not just because of the funding source, but things that are just that are not a priority when we're trying to target and earmark our programs and trying to make the biggest impact in the state. Also a difference in Oregon that we do is we do not hold what is called open competition programs. And that is, there are states, and it's those 50 that all they do is they contract manage. They do a data book, they do an application, they send it out. People fill it out, turn it in, there's a panel that evaluates it, and the Highway Safety Office basically babysits the contracts for the year. There's no input, there's no program, there's no policy discussion, they're just overseeing a contract. We don't do that. We do problem identification within the state, so we target where the money goes because we want to have the biggest impact. And in the 1960s, it was belts, booze, and speed. That's what caused Congress to do something for highway safety, was belts, booze, and speed. And in Oregon, 55% of our fatalities then were related to alcohol. And only 20-some-odd percent of the people in the cars wore seatbelts. We've made tremendous progress in those two. Not so much in the third. Yeah. But it was belts, booze, and speed then. It is still belts, and speed, and booze today. I get the question about, well, then, isn't it belts, booze, and speed all at one time? Well, we developed this, and it's the only one I have seen anywhere in the country, and NHTSA researchers back in Washington, D.C. are trying to look at this and say, how can we do this other places? Three circles on that page. The upper circle is speed. In that circle, 110, 32, 45, and 81, that's 268 fatals per year in this state where speed was a factor in that fatal crash.
Madam Chairman, a question?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, so tell us what you mean by speed. Is it going over the speed limit? Is it going over?
Madam Chair and President Tomei, it is both of what you cite. It is people going over the speed limit or too fast for conditions. So they're entering into a corner carrying so much speed they don't make it out of the corner. Now, the speed limit on the road may be 55. The corner's posted at 25 advisory. The yellow sign means that's what we suggest you do. They could have gone in there 40. They're still below the speed limit of 55, but they carried too fast for conditions. They went through that area. Or if there's adverse weather conditions, it is where these cases are fatal cases. They are investigated, and they do crash diagramming and talk about that the energy of the speed impacted the severity of the injury or the aspects of the crash itself.
Thank you.
Circle to the right is where people are not wearing safety belts, or in this case, these are the car seats and booster seats as well. There's 117 in that circle. And on the far left, this is alcohol. I will make a note, this does not include drugs. For Senator Monroe, because I know interested in drug-involved driving, but the drug part's not in there. Those three, you don't add the black numbers all together because they have crossover, but those three still represent about 60% of the causal factors related to fatal crashes and fatalities in this state. And you can see the interrelationship. I will draw your attention to the one right in the middle, 45. 45 times every year, so basically four times a month, it is alcohol involved, they are going too fast, and they are not wearing their belt. But what's the biggest number on the chart? The 110. That is means that these are people that are not under the influence. They are wearing their belts. They're just going so fast that the safety features of their vehicle or of the road around them can't handle the energy impact of that speed. single leading individual causal factor of all of those out there. Now, they all are a big player, and the reason why safety belts is a little lower than the others is, in part, you'll see, is our safety belt use rate. But it also does not include motorcyclists, bicyclists, and pedestrians. Whereas speed and alcohol can involve those other types of road users, but they don't have the opportunity to wear safety belts or booster seats or car seats, so they're not involved in the no belt area. How do we do outreach? As I mentioned, communication is a big deal. We have tried to stay very, very consistent in our program. And Senator Metzger, you know, through media efforts at times was involved in this, you know, during your career as well, that the messages are out there and we use medium appropriate. Not everything needs to be a TV commercial. That might be the most expensive way to spend your money. To get somebody to take something from a TV commercial and change their behavior behind the wheel, that's a long distance from where they hear it on the TV to when they get in the car. So that's why we very often use billboard or we use radio based on what we're trying to convey. If it's something in relationship to studying or a law change, we might use media. But if it's behavior-based, we're probably going to move it closer to the place where they're actually doing that activity. So we're being wise with our dollars and wise with our medium choice.
I have a quick question myself. On this, the last screen on the 24 drunk, do people report other things besides drunk driving? Or just, how would you know? Irregular driving? What?
Madam Chair, 824 drunk was put in place because at that moment in time, this number has been around for a couple decades, 911 was not everywhere, nor was it necessarily available, mm-hmm. and still isn't. 824 drunk goes to the 911 dispatch center. So it is tracked and logged just like the 911 calls are. What's interesting about this phone number is the safety division actually pays the freight every month. I see the phone bill on this phone line, and it can be anywhere from 50 to 200 calls that come through there. If it's not related to DUI, it's a 911 based or something, it's the 911 center that's getting it. It's not my office or somewhere like that. So it's the right professionals at the right spot. Did that answer your question?
Well, no, I'm not sure it did. Do all calls that come in, do you assume that they're drunk drivers, or if they're just careless?
Madam Chair,
aggressive drivers or other types of activity?
I'm not sure. I could give you actually a personal experience Wednesday night. Coming home from the Trailblazer game, my 17-year-old son was driving the vehicle home, somewhat foggy. We got to Woodburn coming this way, and there was a pickup in front of us, weaving, hitting the center rumble strips all the way over to the slow lane rumble strips. He was driving, so I called in on the cell phone and took instruction from dispatch to follow and for law enforcement to come and play. Me, I'm saying it's a drunk driver, the way they were behaving, slowing down, speeding up, not signaling, all the right signs. Come to find out 24 hours later when I did an inquiry and said, don't tell me something I'm not supposed to know, but I'm just curious what ended up coming. It's just somebody that wasn't paying attention. They were not impaired, but I used this number.
Okay.
But to me, they were straddling at 70 miles an hour, straddling the lane. Boy, my 17-year-old did not want to go 70 to pace the car from behind, so that's breaking the law, Dad. I said, well, we have police on the phone, and they say it's okay for you to go 70.
That was me trying to use my cell phone. That's what it was.
It didn't have Butler on the license plate.
Yeah, right.
The majority of calls do come in on 911, not this line. This is mainly for areas where 911 will not work.
Is that the most effective way to do it, do you think?
Madam Chair, we've talked about, you know, having star something or pound something and getting that out, you run into a lot of competition from that. And what we hear is that all those still go into that same place. And there's an agreement that with the dispatch centers that 911, this is a life and death situation, and there are calls that come in where by the time someone responds, something unfortunate has happened. So it's direct. 911's direct. This is direct. All those other ones do the same thing. They all go into that same place. So why disguise it? It adds a cost as well as potential confusion of getting the wrong numbers. Another thing that's out there is related to DUI and the message of there are all kinds of ways to get a DUI and to be under the influence. However, we'll note that Oregon has one of the most narrow definitions of DUI in the country. We are often looked at as being ahead of the game in impaired driving, and we have slipped the last decade to 15 years, and this is something that for the governor's DUI committee and my office, we need to raise this up. We've lost contact with being in front of this issue, and one of those being the fact that in Oregon it's alcohol, it is controlled substances, pharmaceuticals that are controlled by the regulatory boards, or a list of 35 inhalants. You can be on other substances in your system, low dose of alcohol with something over the counter, something home concocted, whatever, and have a synthetic effect that's just unbelievable, and you will not get charged with DUI. Reckless or careless, same sentence, same type of structure. The issue being, when you're DUI, the person sits in front of somebody that evaluates if they have a substance abuse problem. We've built that into the whole DHS system of out there having evaluations of whether there's a problem. If they're charged reckless or careless, it's going to be the sharp prosecutor that tells the judge there was something engaged, and the judge made an order from the bench to go get evaluated. But it's guaranteed if it's under the DUI area that they're going to have a review before they ever even see the judge. So something to consider. It has been talked about in the last couple sessions about what's in and what's out, and it causes all kinds of interesting policy discussions about what's in and what's not. But that is one of the things that we have fallen behind most states now in relationship to what qualifies as being under the influence when you're behind and operating a vehicle.
Madam Chair? Yeah. On that topic, so on whatever matrix you use, when you compare us to other states in terms of that definition, where would we stand, do you think?
Madam Chair and Senator Metzger, Chair Metzger, sorry. We're going to be in the lower third as far as the breadth of our program, as far as dealing with DUI and if you will, the net that where people would come through. We're behind. There are states that basically now say if you are under the influence of any substance that has the perceptible impairment of your mental or physical factors, that's you're now falling into that area of DUI. Let the evaluation determine whether you were or not. But the cut is on the, if you will, the benefit of the person to see if they are do have a substance abuse problem, versus the other way around and making it more challenging, which is what we have in Oregon. Mentioned in 1960s, we were 55% alcohol related. We come down to 42%, and in 2005, our lowest percentage we have ever achieved since we started tracking this was down to 33%. Still 33%, one out of three. I'm not saying that's, we're done, we can wash our hands and walk away, but it is the lowest percentage that we've ever hit. We are now down and around 175 fatals a year of relationship to alcohol with somebody that's in a principal position, a driver, the pedestrian, or the bicyclist has alcohol in their system. Drug recognition has really started to come up. We have 225 officers around the state, city, county, and OSP that are trained to be drug experts as far as the person's physiological symptoms and signs as dealing with drugs with or all alone, with alcohol or all alone. We now have hit where we're doing over 100 arrests per month around the state. Someone's coming off the road under the influence of drugs while they're driving. We'd like to play for you a radio clip. We'll see if this works across the system. One of the other things that we do also is try and look at situations where we saw a handful of years ago young ladies getting in vehicles with young men that were under the influence and felt that they had to. Situation was they did not have the authority, the power to take themselves out of the situation. So we ran this radio ad. It did win a silver medal in a national competition. And I will say we did run one for young men where there's a young lady in the driver's seat. We did the opposite, but I just brought the one for you that was done early.
Okay, guys, listen up. This is what we like.
Thai food?
Yes.
You paying for Thai food?
Definitely. And we like it when you're for real. You know, none of this, oh, I really care about you stuff, and then treating us like dirt?
Totally. You care about me? Prove it.
Like, don't even think about asking me to get in your car if you've been drinking.
Yeah, what's up with that? Do I look like a crash dummy to you?
I would never put someone I care about in that kind of danger.
And don't play this, but baby, I can handle it thing. No, you can't, and I'll think you're lame if you try.
And guys who lose their license until they're 21 for underage drinking? Seriously, dude, lose my phone number.
You want to impress us? Be real. Show us you're cool without the booze.
Now, you're looking good.
Really good.
Drive sober. It's the way to go.
This message is brought to you by every girl you're ever going to know and the Oregon Department of Transportation.
And I'd also like to point out, in part, this came from a bill Representative Butler sponsored in relationship to the minor in possession, failure to appear, and that minors would basically just not show up in court. So there's a flare in that, if you caught that one line, in relationship to losing your license for underage drinking. So there's a tie to that outreach as well when that bill was put in place. Speeding is the other issue. This is brand new. You may see some of these in relationship to the billboard recently that's starting to do some of the outreach. I will comment on our media program for our office. We pay for creation. We do not pay for time or placement. So everything that our office does is basically, even though there's no requirement for public service announcements anymore, we will pay $450,000 roughly per year for all of our programs, TV, radio, billboard, busboard, water closet media, all of those things, $450,000 total. We get $3.5 to $4 million of space and time for those that report, which is huge. And because we are known, and our programs, they're professional quality, they know who we are very consistent, and so they put our billboards up, they play our TV commercials, not at just 2 in the morning, they play them during rush hour as well, which is, we're very, very fortunate. Speed, as I mentioned, is number one. 263 individuals, it is now 54% of the fatal crashes out there, have a speed or speeding involvement in them. It's an increase up from 193, which, rather interesting, is you look at 166,000 speeding convictions on the DMV driving record every year. Every year. So that's quite a high percentage of people. As we mentioned, it has now passed impaired driving as the number one. Third big area is in safety belts. This is a billboard that we ran because of the citizen initiative that passed, that went in 1990, where this was passed, talked about all seating positions, having to wear belts, having to wear it properly. The legislature has been great in relationship to the last decade, looking at certain situations. I know Senator Metzger was involved with the transport vehicles due to unfortunately the death of the figure skater's mother in Portland. Last session we talked about some of the delivery vehicles, and you looked at that and debated it and said that loophole needs to be closed. One of the things that's out there is how you wear the belt. It needs to be there and to be effective. We are one of the top states, not just in the country, but in the world. Our survey looking at all seating positions in the vehicle is 97% this year, the highest mark we've ever made. To compare state to state to state, they only look at the driver and the other passenger in the front. You just look at those two, Oregon's 95.3%. Right now, as best I can tell, we're number 3 in the country. But even that is one of the best rates in the world in relationship to safety belts. Women still buckle up more than men. And when there are more people in the car, more people do buckle up. The booster seat bill law that you debated and passed last session is going to help, because that's going to get that 6- and 7-year-old where the belt doesn't fit correctly. It's all about getting the belt to come across the collarbone and the sternum and the chest and not across the neck or not behind the back, because then they end up being loose in the vehicle or end up having the belt not work the way it's designed to.
So does that mean I need a booster?
You can change your seating position and change the anchor point. This next video, I had talked briefly with Chair Metzger about it. It is from Ireland. And the reason why I have it in here instead of from Oregon is because it's the best thing we have seen that talks about why you have loopholes closed in your seatbelt law. There is slow motion. It does show a crash scene. It is all actors and everything else, but it is very real looking. And so it can grab you. So I just want to give you a little bit of warning in relationship to this. It's graphic in relationship to this one individual in the seat, in the back seat, that is not belted in a very slow 25-mile-an-hour crash. It's a PSA done in Ireland. They have a whole different take on some of these things than we do, much more up front instead of being passive like we are typically in media. So I'll go ahead and play it. It's about a 45-second TV PSA.
Body to body, pocket to pocket, we know how to rock the party.
This is Michael. Today he's going to hit his girlfriend so hard, she ends up with permanent brain damage.
Three
Three dead in this vehicle. Charlotte's critical. They say the guy without the seatbelt did the damage.
No seatbelt, no excuse.
And even though we're at 97%, you saw the 117 earlier in the slides, 117 deaths in this state where somebody's not wearing their seatbelt, not in the car seat, not in the booster seat. If they just simply buckle up, that number can be cut in half. 3% unbelted, but they represent about 35% of our deaths on the roads. That just tells you that when you're not belted and you're not in the right position of your vehicle, you can do damage to others or you can do damage to yourself if you're not letting the car and the safety equipment around you work for you. And I very much appreciate your patience, and as we've gone through this program and evaluated the safety belt law and the car seat laws and things, that you've been very diligent in trying to close those down and close those down, because that's not a very high-speed crash. But the young man was doing only 25 miles an hour. But that's fast enough to have done, as you see, you know, the damage. It's you know, there's actors and stuff in it, but that's probably one of the best portrayals I have ever seen in the last 20 years of what can happen if you're not particularly belted in.
Troy, can I
ask?
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. Troy, why couldn't that be shown like driver's education or high schools or whatever?
Madam Chair and Representative Tomei, those types of things can be when it's a set audience, and there are things where they bring up real life and they do show crash tests and crash test dummies where they've run vehicles and side impact and into a pillar and some things like that. The United States is just is passive on this. I have gotten lots of requests to be able to grab that video, and we have to make sure we get from Ireland, get the appropriate ability to bring it and have it shown directly. I don't think it would get a reaction, public service announcements to go on the main TV, but to do things like that in the driver education course, they have that option to do this, and they do those types of things. They visit the morgue. They visit crash scenes. They visit victim impact panels sometimes with the driver education courses or as part of a judicial sentence as a conviction of a traffic ticket. I just don't know. Our general national culture is not to be in your face like that as much as there are in some other parts of the country. We passed our law in 1990. Most of the European countries had mandatory seatbelt laws in 1970. They've had it a lot longer, and so they're in a different place in the expectation of you should be wearing it, because they've all, for the most part, the drivers have all grown up with that as an expectation, but we haven't yet.
Yes. Can you tell us the statistics of it seems to me that I remember reading that the highest reason for children's deaths is traffic accidents.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, from the age of 1 to generally the age of 35 to 37, the number one leading cause of death and life years lost is from traffic crashes.
I just remember a couple of years ago when Jessica's law, when we were debating that, you know, when people hear about sex abuse, it's like we cannot have one more child die. But there is not that attitude. We cannot have one more child die in a traffic accident. That is appalling to me about safety seats for children. I can't understand.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, I appreciate your interest and your energy. We're very fortunate. On page 111 in the book, it does talk about children aged 0 to 14. And part of what we can somewhat celebrate is that the young children, the numbers are under 10. The number of deaths in the young age group is a pretty low number. We do know that we went for quite a few years where we had no child that was unbelted or not in a seat that died. The last year or two, we've had some. And so that's why the attention on the booster seat came back up. Instead of relying on people to do it themselves, the community at large said, we need to talk about a law because we're starting to see people just avoid it. We need to re-up that to get kids back into the seats. So it's in part fortunate because there are not very many. But I agree with you, it's unfortunate because you do every once in a while see kids bopping around in the back of cars not in, and you wonder what they're thinking about as far as not understanding the danger to that kid and a danger to themselves. As you saw that other video, someone in the back seat, something happens, they end up launching into you in the front.
Right.
So. Other things the legislature's done recently, which would like just to hit a couple real quick to wrap up. In general, I really appreciate the fact that you all have a general expectation of highway safety being a part of the conversation and calling into question things that aren't working right. as well as saying there are things we need to do better. You had that earlier this afternoon in some of your conversation. I'll show you a slide around the teen driving license law that was changed in 1999 and what an impact that's done. Safety corridors, permanent status this last session. We've had a handful of safety corridors that have been decommissioned, meaning they're no longer labeled a safety corridor. All of them have stayed below the state average. It has been a success. And some, and I know Senator Metzger has been involved in one on US 26. Senator Berger has been involved in on 101, where they've been decommissioned, but they continue to perform correctly and safely. Speed limits is an impact. As I said, it's number one, and it's one of the things on our radar screen to continue to watch for what's going on there. And the fact that you've closed those loopholes. And finally, I can't say, but you have started to increase the staffing to Oregon State Police, which is a big boost not only to state highways, but it also impacts cities and counties as well as far as cross coverage goes. In relation to driver education, that change went in. The provisional license was put in place. And our media campaign did win a gold medal throughout the DMV world in relationship to how that was done. But what has happened? The law went into effect in 1999. So we don't look at 99 because it was a big topic of conversation. It was actually the number three or number four highest rated bill during the 99 session as far as being passed from this building. So look, the year before, 16-year-olds behind the wheel when someone was killed or injured, 1,158. Fast forward to 2005, down to 656, 43% reduction. That's where the restrictions are. That's where the provisional license is. But look what it's done to 17-year-olds. They're getting it. It's having an impact. And we're doing work now on the 18, 19, 20, and 21 to say, is it carrying through? It is. National, our model of the law that we put in was supposed to only have a 10 to 12% impact. It had a 43% impact. That was where we organized that whole program. And in 1999, with some tweaks along the way over the last decade, have made the provisional license tied to driver ed, parent involvement. It's been a success. This is huge. And when you start looking at then where we're heading and what's going on, this is part of the reason why our numbers are going down across the state as far as death and injuries. We also focus on motorcycle. Part of the outreach there is this issue of share the road, the vulnerable road user, making sure people are there. We have held our own the last 4 or 5 years as far as motorcycle deaths go. We are not this year. We're already 5 deaths more this year compared to all of last year. This year, motorcycle deaths will be the highest since the motorcycle helmet law was put back in place. Now, we've typically been able to hold 35 to 40 motorcycle deaths per year. Even with increased ridership, it's now up at 47, and it may start to approach 50. Now, it's not the 80s and 90 deaths that we had when we had no helmet law. Now, those came down into the 40s, but it's crept back up. But we have done a much better job than the nation. That is, the motorcycle deaths have been skyrocketing. You've probably heard that. U.S. Department of Transportation Secretary Mary Peters talked about motorcycles being a big push for her organization. We've been very fortunate because we've all worked together. All the groups work together about training, outreach, having the helmet law in place. That's what's helped us there. One of the big things about motorcycle ridership now is the unendorsed rider killing themselves, people that don't have a motorcycle license, 12 of those so far this year, where they're not licensed to ride a motorcycle and they end up killing themselves.
Madam Chair, question?
Yes.
Troy, have you surveyed those? Several states have repealed their motorcycle helmet laws. Have you surveyed those states, and what is the what has been the impact on fatalities in those states that have repealed helmet laws or modified their helmet laws?
Madam Chair and Senator Monroe, there are a handful of states that have repealed their helmet laws and have seen the deaths go up and the severe injuries go up, bar none. In Louisiana, and I'm trying to remember one other state, they reinstated the helmet law because the fact that the deaths were unacceptable and the injuries were unacceptable. It didn't stay a non-helmet law state very long and came back down. It takes longer, though, to bring it down because you've got to deal with compliance-related issues. And there are some national studies. I don't have them with me, but there are some national studies, if you're interested, that we can share with you on those state-specific what happened. Every case, deaths and injuries went up. When they put helmet law back in, they started to come back down again.
Thank you.
On this page, since 1950 to date, unfortunately, I want to say there's 30,000 dead people on that page. That's how many people have died on Oregon's roads and streets since 1950 just because we have a public transportation system. Now, it's interesting, the yellow line, you see we're doing a much better job ever since Congress acted in the late 1960s, and this body acted in the 1960s to create the Highway Safety Office to begin with, of getting those numbers to come down. Now, the last handful of years, you see we have 511 there, but the rest of them are underneath 500. Cruise to the left. When's the last time we were like that? Well, that was actually when Dwight Eisenhower was in the White House. And that's pure count. Yet our population state is much bigger than it was in the 1950s. Many, many more roads, many, many more cars. Shows you that we are having a success. This is not based on miles traveled, based on vehicles, based on roads. This is pure people, and we're having a difference. This is where we need to be in the blue. Our goal is to get down to 370 by 2010. That's huge. That's a 3 to 5% reduction per year, every year, for the next four years or so to get there. And where are we? As of November 4th, we were at 370 compared to November 4th last year, 394. We're 6% down. The report I got this morning, not early enough to change the slide, that says we're down 24. We're now down 26 compared to last year at this time. So things you're doing, things we're doing collectively through the engineering efforts, the education efforts, the enforcement efforts, and the emergency medical services, we're having a difference person count-wise of reducing death and injuries on Oregon's roads and streets. So where do we go? As I mentioned, impaired driving is an issue. It is different than it was 20 years ago. Many, many more substances out there, many more situations. Every time you hear about a levy or that the federal timber tax conversation, one of the things that happens is law enforcement for traffic comes up as a thing that might get cut. And we do not have redundancy in our public safety system for EMTs, firefighters, volunteers, law enforcement, anywhere across the board. But we've got to make a difference there. And we need to make sure that when we build roads, whether it be city, county, or state, that safety is put into play, as you were talking about during your first panel, making sure it's done right at the beginning so you're not living with fixes that you have to deal with later and come back and deal with it again. Some things also to consider is training. The driver education program tied with the graduate driver licensing is making a difference, as you saw. We do not have mandatory driver education in the state, nor do we take the revenue program related to that money and make sure that all of the people that are involved, public and private, are all in there equally. There's a statutory bar for me being able to help financially some of the private companies that are teaching kids at the state standard or above. And we'd like to be able to have that conversation with them about if they so choose that we have the ability to subsidize their operation in order to make it lower costs for moms and dads and uncles and aunts and grandparents and foster parents to get their kids through driver ed, because it works. The performance of kids through driver ed are 11 to 13% better than those that do not. So as much as we've had a decline, the kids in driver ed are doing even better. And we want to make sure we keep the partnership. By having the four E's at the table all at the same time, we have the best comprehensive answer to the problem that we can get. And as you saw earlier, we are making a difference, continue to make a difference, but we're not going to rest on our laurels. We still want to drive the numbers farther down in order to continue to reduce the toll of having a public road system in our state. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any more questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Troy, thank you very much for the presentation. One of the concerns that I have in my district is that I'm fearful that roads are built to a standard, and I'm going to go back to one of the E's, one of the engineering, that roads are built to a standard statewide, which may not apply to high desert rural eastern Oregon. Specifically, I think that the freeways do an excellent job, and that they are built probably much to the same standard on I-5 as they are on I-84 as it comes to the east. My concern is the off-ramps. Those off-ramps, virtually anywhere where I have trucks that are pulling up and parking on an off-ramp, waiting for a traffic signal or waiting for an opportunity to merge, probably more traffic signal oriented, I actually run into situations where I took a measurement to it twice in the last 3 years that the trucks had actually created ruts that were 12 inches deep on the freeway off ramp. My concern is that you can't remove snow, and I can be high centered on it. My concern is, what about the engineering statewide? Is it still one size fits all, or do we actually stop to try and say, hey, wait a minute, we're going to have cars parked over here and trucks parked over here, and in eastern Oregon, where it may be 120 degrees in the shade, it's going to be different than what it is in downtown Portland in the shade.
And Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I cannot answer the question. I'll have to take note of that and look and see what are the guidelines in relationship to the infrastructure descriptions about you know, the interstates versus the arterials versus the collectors versus the surface streets, and what standards are put in place. It's just, that's not my area of expertise. I'd have to go back and
ask. And I appreciate that, Madam Chair. My concern is that this has been an issue that we've raised with the Department of Transportation before, that one size doesn't really fit all across the state, and we really need to probably take a look at that engineering issue again for some of those parts of the state which don't have the same weather conditions. Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
It was a very interesting presentation. And I'm going to close that public hearing, and I'm going to open a public hearing on the Oregon mileage fee, and Jim Whitney. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here now after 6 years after we got started with the Road User Fee Pilot Program. This isn't working, but we have paper copies. I'm used to... good.
You might introduce yourself, Jim, for the record.
Yes, Jim Whitty, manager of the Office of Innovative Partnership and Alternative Funding at the Oregon Department of Transportation. This whole adventure started six years ago in the 2001 session when the House Transportation Committee decided to take a look at futuristic vehicles. And they looked at something really odd at the time, a hybrid electric, which nobody had seen much of yet. They also looked at biofuels, looked at natural gas vehicles, and a hydrogen fuel cell concept car. And as they talked about amongst themselves, they said, they wondered what would happen if these vehicles took hold in the marketplace. What would happen to our gas tax? We are 60% dependent upon state and federal. And the truck taxes, which are now pegged to the gas taxes. What would happen to our road revenues? So they passed slide two. They passed a bill creating the Road User Fee Task Force, which started its work November 30, 2001. Okay. Well, on slide two, anyway, the legislative mandate is as written: develop an alternative revenue collection system to replace the current system, which is essentially the gas tax. And as I was the administrator assigned to that task force, and I was assigned an economist to work with me part-time, and we kept going, we looked at 28 different revenue sources. And we kept going back to the gas tax because it was so well-designed from a policy perspective. It raises a lot of money. Let's face it, it does do that. It's easy to pay. It's embedded in commercial transactions. It's easy to collect, and then only 157 distributors pay it. It's easy to administer, and then ODOT basically performs an auditing function. Costs about $1 million a year. Minimal evasion, and that these is only 157 taxpayers, and there's very few illegal gasoline sales. Protects privacy. Nobody knows where anybody's driving, and there's only a minimal burden on the retail business, which bears the burden of evaporation of the gas.
Madam Chair, I want to know how to get one of my stations on this picture that he had there. And I also want to know where to buy that fuel at that price right now, too.
You're going to depress us all unless you take any pictures, I think.
I'm going to have to be more current.
Well, that's Leathers Fueling, which is the service station that was in our pilot program, and I want to honor them. And it was a historical point in time that they were helping us. But the gas tax, the task force so quickly discovered, is not so perfect. It's not connected to the highway system anymore. Used to be way back when cars in around 1960 or so got similar miles per gallon. You drove more, you put a greater burden on the system, and you paid more to pay for that, keeping up with that additional burden. Now, these days, we have vehicles that have a broad range. So they put the same burden on the road system, roughly, but they don't pay the same anymore. And so we're going to see revenue erosion.
Is that true, Madam Chair, if I may? Is that true with regard to the weight mile as well, Mr. Whitty?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, we didn't really look at the weight mile tax so much during this program. We thought it was in the task force thought it was in pretty good shape and didn't want to adjust it particularly.
My guess, Madam Chair, is the reason for that is that the weight mile is adjusted for the amount of weight and the number of gallons that are used. So it probably doesn't have the skew that gasoline may.
But likely not. This was in a graph prepared by our economist a few years back. The blue line on top is a base case line. This is no change going forward. We've already experienced change. We know change is coming with changing the new vehicles, but that's the base case line. The next three lines are whenever you ask an economist for a line, they'll give, or for a prediction, they'll give you three lines: optimistic, pessimistic, and the one in the middle. Unfortunately, the optimistic line we were giving, the pink line, basically predicted a return to $1.50 a gallon. So we've kind of already started dismissing that line as unrealistic. So we're left with the bottom two. And the bottom two would indicate that we're in a permanent decline of our road revenues around 2017 to 2023. Now, if there were increases in the gas tax, you might push that out a little bit. But basically, without any change, even with vehicle miles traveled increases, you're in a permanent decline in 10 to 15 years. So the solution the task force came up with was the per-mile charge or the mileage fee, electronically collected, charged on in-state miles to replace the fuel tax, state fuel tax. There were two purposes the task force set forth for this pilot program. One was to create the alternative to the gas tax, and secondly, to create an electronically collected system that could assist in management of road congestion, basically a congestion charge. So there's two independent purposes here. Fundamental to the Oregon concept, we call it the Oregon mileage fee concept because I've had to give this talk in a number of states in the country, and so we call it the Oregon mileage fee concept. The fundamental to it is the creation of zones. So you'd have a zone for the state of Oregon, a zone outside the state of Oregon. You could have a local option zone for a county or a city. You could also have rush hour, meaning time of day charges, should that be desired. The way the electronic collection occurs is that there's a GPS receiver in the car that receives signals from a satellite. Embedded in that device is a latitude and longitude markers which outline the zones. And when a vehicle drives into a zone, now they are counting miles from the odometer in that zone as opposed to another zone. Now, it's important to say at this point, because we've heard this, believe me, over and over, this is not a tracking device. The reason we know it's not a tracking device is because a tracking device has to have two functions. It has to have the receiving function, which I just mentioned, and secondly, it has to have a continuous transmission outward that someone else can pick up to follow the device around. The device we used in the pilot program did not have that second function. It only had the receiving element. Then when the car pulls up to a fueling station, and there is an association of the device electronically with wireless data reading with a fuel pump. And then the data from the various zones is transmitted wirelessly to the fuel pump, which goes to the point of sale system. And then ODOT enters the picture only here. We are not installing anything in the cars. We are not reading anything or getting any information. We enter at this point. We get three things. We get identification of the vehicle, like electronic license plate. Secondly, we get mileage totals in each zone. No travel history is stored or kept. So only mileage totals, basically odometer totals in each zone. And then third thing is the amount of fuel purchased. That's necessary to have an audit trail or to challenge a billing. Then that data goes back to the last reading is subtracted from previous readings. The mileage charges are applied, and it goes back to the service station where they are presented with the billing. And as you see, the VMT fee, it's called here, is added, and the gas tax is deducted. This is precisely the system that was tested in the road user fee pilot project. It ran beginning in April 2006 and ended last March. We had 285 participant vehicles. We had paid them compensation, otherwise they never would have participated. We started with the control phase, which is a base case, and then to determine what behavior changes might have occurred, and then the experiment phase. The experiment phase, we had three groups: the control groups, which paid the gas tax continually, and the VMT group, which paid the basic per mile charge, the 1.2 cents per mile, which was equivalent to the gas tax for the average motor vehicle that gets 20 miles per gallon. And then the rush hour group paid more. They paid 10 cents per mile during rush hour periods, 7 to 9 a.m. in the morning and 4 to 6 p.m. in the evening. We had to reduce their mileage charge to their basic mileage charge to 0.43 cents because of a commitment made at a place like this in the 2001 legislature that we would not raise any money off of this pilot project. So ordinarily they probably would have been at the 1.2, but we kept our promise. Okay, this is the rush hour zone that was used in the pilot project. You see it's the boundaries of the Metropolitan Planning Organization for the City of Portland. We proved that you could do a rush hour time of day charge in a special boundary like this. We could also prove this could facilitate local option. On the left, we had a screen so every participant could know, am I in which zone? They could read which zone was ticking. So we had the rush hour zone on the top. You can't really read that. The in Oregon, out of Oregon, and there was a no signal zone, which, by the way, we learned generally means you're driving underground parking or in a tunnel. The results. The zone differentiation worked beautifully. Mileage counting was fine. Transaction administration was good. Where we had a little bit of trouble was with the identification of the vehicle with the pump. Not for every vehicle. Some vehicles had trouble and other vehicles didn't. And the reason is it had to do with the installation of these prototype devices. We had car toys install devices basically designed by Oregon State University, created in Corvallis by a local manufacturer, and then applied. And some of the applications weren't the best. What this taught us is that retrofitting is extremely difficult. Retrofitting is hard because cars don't have standardized ports like a computer does. And so every car is basically designed from the ground up. Some models will have common features, but not always. And so this told us that retrofitting needs to be solved, and we don't recommend it at this point. We believe that this technology needs to be refined by the auto manufacturers and technology companies working with the auto manufacturers and designed for vehicles, not added to them after sale. It should be added prior to sale. Once there was an association with the pump, we had 100% transmission accuracy. And then you'll notice two other really fun findings. The peak period driving reduced 22% their driving during peak periods. And then finally, the one result I'm particularly happy with, we polled the participants at the end, and 91% said they'd be willing to keep the devices in their cars and continue paying a mileage fee if the system were extended statewide. Needs more work. I mentioned perfecting vehicle identification. The cash transaction time was a little slow. Credit worked fabulously, perfectly. We had a little trouble with cash in that somebody wanted to pay a certain amount. Now, what was shown on the pump was no longer what they were going to pay because the mileage fee didn't connect the same way. And so there was a little time added there. We know that if we would ever implement this, that we'd have to solve that problem. Retrofitting is difficult, and that technical assistance would be important for the fueling stations.
So I have a quick question. Are there any vehicles being made now that have equipment on them that would work for this?
Madam Chair, not yet. There are devices, there are cars that have navigation units that have GPS receivers in them, but they don't have the short range radio frequency built in.
I think in Europe they may, Madam Chair. The trucks in Europe.
Ah, yes. Madam Chair, Representative Butler, in Europe, in Germany, trucks are using a GPS payment system right now, the heavy trucks, like the ones that would be subject to our weight distance tax.
Okay.
I don't believe they have the radio frequency element, however, because they do it differently there. There are two main issues that have come up over these past 6 years. We've heard from a lot of the public and a lot of people, so I pretty much know what all the issues are. Two big ones, privacy, and that makes sense. And I want to make sure that everybody understands that I remember it was Senator Joanne Berger, when she was a state rep, back in the first meeting 6 years ago, said, we must design something or we're not invading anybody's privacy. We did our best to do that. I told you about the fact we don't have this homing system going out somebody could pick up, but also there's no travel history stored. A navigation unit does store a travel history, but we basically erase that as it goes, so there's nothing stored in the vehicle, and that was tested. So not to say it's easy to communicate this with the public. It's not. But if given the time and the patience, we can get people to understanding on this. We've done focus groups on this. But not everybody believes it either. There's a small group that still is suspicious. The other big issue is, what do you do about the rate? Now, we tested a flat rate in the pilot. Every car pays the same rate. Well, that creates winners and losers, and it just so happens that the winners are the gas-guzzling vehicles, and the losers are the more fuel-efficient vehicles. And the task force decided not to structure anything fancy to fix that. What they decided to do is they realized it was a legislative issue, and that the legislature, at some point, if they decided to try to structure this thing, would take a lot of policy factors into account and create a structure that would work for the legislature and therefore the public. One possibility is what I call a stacked rate. You have a flat rate because you have to pay something that doesn't reduplicate the problems of the gas tax. So the upper end should pay a flat rate, but you do some things with the lower end, either keep them on the fuel tax or have a penalty or something like that, so that basically there's an incentive to trade up. But there's a lot of things you can do with the rate. The system is not the limiting factor. The limiting factor is the policy considerations and the imagination of the people creating that system. Visitors, we've had a lot of visitors. This was Mary Peters, right after she was selected as the U.S. DOT secretary, came out and visited. We had people from Texas, Wisconsin, state of Washington come out, Minnesota. I also had the opportunity to testify in front of the two National Surface Transportation Commissions created by the Safety Bill about this. I expect you'll see some mention of this in their reports that are due in December. Key steps to implementation. Again, to reiterate one point, we used prototype technologies. You've got to make them refined. You don't take prototypes to commercial use. There's always another step, which is refinement. And that's something that has to happen next before this thing will be ready to implement. And then we have to go through the automobile manufacturers. They have to be on board, or we're not going to be able to do this. And then finally, the fuel distribution industry is the second major group that we have to get consent from. We are studying the various effects right now. Oregon State University is undertaking that. Timeline to implementation. This was something the national commissions were very interested in. And I'm not embarrassed to say a small single state is unlikely to implement this by ourselves. There's just too much politics, if nothing else. And secondly, you need a fair amount of development capital to take this to refinement technology. So a consortium of small states, which frankly is not out of the question, there are a number of states that are seriously looking at this, could take probably 10 to 12 years, because you just wouldn't have the resources necessary to implement it in a shorter period of time. But if you had a strong effort by USDOT, or a large state like California, you could take this thing quickly. Maybe 3 to 5 years. The technology refinement is not the thing dragging this. It's really the politics that will slow this down, and communications with the public. The public has to accept this. You know, we're not going to probably have them banging on your door saying, please enact this. But they may well say, yeah, we understand what the situation is, and we understand we've got to move on to something else. I don't think they're quite there yet. From what I talked to people, they don't quite understand the problem we're addressing. That has to come first. If they understand the problem we're addressing, then they'll say, okay, what are the solutions? And now we have a chance. I also want to mention that there is an alternative. to the system we've created. One is to, it's a system that doesn't create zones. It basically estimates the vehicle miles traveled by having electronic chip in the license plate, which has identification and vehicle fuel efficiency rating. That can be read at the fuel pump to estimate against the gas purchase the miles driven. You don't create zones, so you're limited. You're losing certain opportunities, but it would be a lot less expensive, and it doesn't use GPS. So that's something that we have not tested, but we actually figured out about 5 years ago was an alternative. That basically is my presentation, and I'll be happy to take questions, Madam Chairman.
Any questions, Representative Butler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one question, Jim. In this process, did you anticipate, or did you take a look at the possibility with regard to passenger vehicles that there's a great difference in the weight of passenger vehicles too, and one passenger vehicle and some of that will be reflective obviously in the miles per gallon, but for instance, if you had a van that was included in this process and the van was in fact carrying people in to go to work, a 12 passenger van in to go to work, and as it was driving along, it was picking up. And then as it was slowing down in the process in the metropolitan area, it would be dropping off people, or perhaps it's a van that would be carrying commercial items for sale and doing a drop off in a metropolitan area, but commuting from a different zone. I know there are weight strips out there in the highways. Is that something that you considered, including in an eventual nature of this concept, the calculations in this concept?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, it was considered very early on. We looked at the cost allocation studies that are done basically to determine what the various weights of passenger vehicles, what the impacts would be. So we didn't specifically look at those kinds of vehicles like a van, but just general generic vehicles. What we learned from the people that work on that is that passenger vehicles don't have a major impact on the substructure, which is the most expensive structure to keep up. That basically those are designed for the heavy trucks.
Okay.
And so the issue with passenger vehicles is usually space. If there was some element from a cost allocation study that was relevant, if that was to pop up for some reason, you could have different rates for different vehicles. This particular system can be used to create those differences, those variances.
Thank you.
We just use a flat rate in this test.
Thanks, Jim. Well, thanks for all your work on this, and I think that it's it really puts in the groundwork done for clearly where I believe we mean the entire United States, not just Oregon, is going to be moving in something like this, whether it's exactly this model, because we're all facing the same issue of especially as we look at the environmental impacts of transportation and trying to move to be, you know, a less carbon footprint, but that's carbon is what's paying the tax. We have to come up with the solution to pay for the infrastructure, and I think this experiment was really good. And I think you're right about public perception is something that doesn't happen overnight, but that's one thing that will work. And, you know, you'll have someone who, because they really don't understand it, and it's new, and everything new always has a 70% objection rate because I'm not familiar with it, so I'm a no. You know, I mean, that's just, there's all kinds of studies have been done on that. And at the same standpoint, they'll worry about collection of their miles while they're just loving the fact that they're paying $49 a month for their OnStar, which does tell you exactly where they are at all times and actually pay for the privilege to be able to have this great tracking device, or a LoJack or the cell phone in their pocket to realize that people know exactly what cell zone you are. And I think as people get more comfortable with technology and realize a lot of the other issues that are involved there, and how we can develop a system, a VMT system, that actually is much more private than a lot of the other tools that we take for granted every day, I think that will come about. And the work that you did in presenting this program is just the first step on that. And I think it was just it was excellent. I think you've identified the issues very, very clearly. And as we continue to work on that, I hope we'll have a phase two that will start looking at some of the refinements and find other people around the country who, you know, see Oregon really as a leader in this, will make their contributions and then collectively come up with a real innovative way to make sure that we can maintain our infrastructure fairly paid for by all of us who use it. And so I just want to thank you for the great work, and we're farther ahead now than we would have been had you not had your leadership on this issue. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, I want to tell you about the document just briefly.
Okay.
We have a document that will be sent all over the place. It will be available electronically. It is awful complete. Given the history of this thing, it'll be available electronically in November. I'm trying to beat Thanksgiving, but layout and proofreading and all that takes time. And then a hard copy will be available in December. But I'll be sending you all the Transportation Committee members electronic copy first, and then followed by the hard copy.
Thank you.
You can just do the electronic for me. I don't need the paper.
Me too. I have no office to put it in.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming in. Thank you for the update. And I'm going to close the public hearing on that. And I guess the next thing we have on our agenda is looking at committee bill introduction. And I see the Senate has got a full...
I am the Senate.
Do you have anything to say about what you're doing before?
Well, that's a good question. I did want to ask you, or I could just ask here, is I believe that the only committee bill that we have is the legal presence bill. I have not heard from any other members. And I don't know about individual bills, but no one has approached me from the Senate about a transportation bill. I am interested in asking on the card lock issue. I know you've been familiar with that.
Yes.
Will that fit under what you're trying to do? Because that would be the only other issue, whether the relating clause would be broad enough that could be put inside whatever you're planning on the House side.
And I'm not sure. And I haven't heard back from Paul Romaine on that. I know he was still kind of looking around, and I don't know if he's checked in with you. But, I mean, it's a possibility. And at this point, I don't think I have the option of doing a separate bill for that,
right.
But I think we can look at whether or not that's another thing that can fit under the relating clause. If this fix for 2936 is the one that we choose to introduce.
I would say I'd appreciate if, because I know the deadline's Thursday, I guess, and I have to go to Coos Bay tomorrow, but if you check with Heidi or whatever in Legislative Council and see if that issue would fit or not. At least we'll know the answer. If it is, that would kind of solve that problem and, you know, have one less bill floating out there. If not, then we could approach Speaker Merkley or President Courtney and see if there's any other way.
Can you remind me what issue you're bringing up here?
Right? Well, it's basically a technical fix to a previous piece of legislation. It's from all accounts not a controversial. It's just there's where retails and card locks are on the same premise. There's confusion as to what the language is of existing policy. So they want to make it clear that the policy doesn't change just because there is happen to be a card lock on a retail piece of property. That's a pretty generic deal, but it appears to be a technical change. So,
thank you.
Okay. So it sounds like right now the Senate is introducing legal presence, we have the fix for House Bill 2936, which most of you should be very familiar with, and Don Miner's here to talk about it. He can tell us why it's really important that we do this in 08. And we also have had, since we've had these discussions, another request on a bill, which I'm not very familiar with, and so Scott Ashcrum can come up and kind of explain what he's looking for, and then we can see where we're going. So,
Madam Chair, if it's okay, I think I'll adjourn my Senate members as you do your work. Thank you all for attending. I'll let you do your work.
Good to see all of you.
Like a teeter-totter.
I know.
The side of the dice is going to float.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association, standing in for Bob Russell, who's in Arizona and can't be here. Just a quick background. Last session, it was discovered that some folks found it make a cost-benefit analysis, maybe is a shorthand way of saying it, in deciding whether or not they would obey certain requirements of permits that allow them to move over-dimensional loads. One of those requirements is that you have pilot vehicles or escort vehicles, and it costs a couple hundred dollars. And if you didn't and were found out, it was 90-some dollars. And so a bill was introduced to enhance that penalty. It went up to about $700. Unfortunately, the language may have been a bit overbroad because it applied to all terms of the trip permit or the authorization to move it, so that it would apply to the requirement that you have a sign that said oversized load. And if that were faded or the wrong letter size, it's the same penalty, and that was never intended. So the fix is to say that if you fail to have the proper number of escort vehicles or you go take a different route, that you would have the Class A violation penalty of $720. I'm less familiar with the other item. It deals with removing vehicles from the roadway. Apparently,
you don't have any comment on that one?
My understanding is that this is also not controversial. It deals with the roadway itself as well as the shoulder of the road. And it makes clear that no person has been injured, so that would include a vehicle that struck a pedestrian. So the bill that passed last session dealt with the driver. So. And again, to my understanding, there is no controversy on these changes.
Okay. Any questions? All right. So then I guess we'll take a minute to hear from Scott. And get a little history on what he's looking for.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott Ashcombe with the Oregon Agricultural Alliance. The Oregon Ag Alliance is a nonprofit organization. We're a general farm organization. We have nurseries, farms, and ranches throughout the state of Oregon. Our members are usually fairly large producers with a fair number of employees that are really in agriculture as a business. I bring before you today a request for a courtesy introduction by the committee of a piece of legislation relating to airport planning areas. The bill could be related to land use or it could be related to transportation. We're not asking really for the support of the committee or the opposition of the committee on the legislation, just simply to allow us to use the committee to get the bill introduced, and then we'll take up the selling of the bill, if possible, in the Aud 8 session. I've given you a piece of writing here, very short, because I don't want to take much of your time up, but this is quite a simple bill, although it's fairly lengthy. The meat of the bill is described in the second and third paragraph of my letter to you here. In short, really, the bill simply it defines a residential single-family air park, which is not currently defined in the airport planning statutes. We've fleshed out that definition with the definition of single-family residential air park found in the Arizona law, and added that to the definition found in the airport planning statutes. And then the bill does two simple things. It creates a 3-mile perimeter called an airport planning area around all public use airports. And we limit the bill to public use airports, of which there are approximately 90 in the state of Oregon. And then it creates another kind of a planning area, which is a residential single-family air park, which restricts the uses that can be made of land inside the 300-foot distance of an airport, a public use airport runway. And we're talking only about public use airports that are located inside or adjacent to acknowledged urban growth boundaries. It restricts residential airport development to land within 300 feet of airports that meet that criteria. And the last thing that the bill does is to add the land in the perimeter, the airport planning area perimeter, the 3-mile perimeter from the runways, to add that land to the exemption section of Measure 37. And that is undertaken for safety reasons. The notion that if somebody is able to build a high-rise building, for example, in the glide path of a public use airport, because of the fact that they acquired that property prior to the effective date of the regulation that prohibits it, that it might cause a significant health hazard or safety hazard if that were allowed to be accomplished. So the land inside the planning scoping perimeter is exempt from Measure 37 claims. That's the bill. I want to add that this measure is actually a grassroots effort. It's not coming from our organization necessarily. The Oregon Flying Farmers had this idea, and Andy Anderson is here. Just, I would like you briefly to meet Andy Anderson, who generated this idea. I think it's quite visionary. It's a genuine grassroots effort, and we would like to ask your permission as a courtesy to introduce the measure in the audit session. Let me just say that Andy has brought some testimony that you have before you, and the testimony refers to House Bill 3153. Certain concepts of the bill that I put before you today was in House Bill 3153, but the relating clause was too attractive to be resisted in the last session because it was related to land use. And so it was one of the bills that was held hostage by the Joint Committee on Measure 37, and we were in the running to be Measure 49, but we didn't quite win that race, thank heavens. But anyway, this is Andy Anderson of the Oregon Flying Farmers, and he's got some pictures to show you.
Madam Chair and committee people. I was.
You want to go ahead and introduce? I know he's introduced you, but
yeah.
We need you to.
Okay, fine. Well, my name is W.L. Andy Anderson. I reside at 803 Cessna Street in Independence, at the airpark in Independence, and I've been flying for some 60 years. And so flying is a way of life for me. And so I am concerned about airports. And because, like highways, you have to have a place to land if you're going to take off from one point to another. And the testimony that I had written for you was based on the work that we've done for House Bill 3153, which did not happen, but we're anxious to have this idea of protecting airports through planning, long-range planning, that would prevent the kind of urban sprawl that has been taking about one airport every 2 weeks in the nation. And we don't want that to happen in Oregon. So our idea is to have an airport planning area or an airport protection area that would have the kind of zoning within the 3 miles or within closer proximity to the airport that would keep the airport operational as an airport. And as Mr. Cott mentioned, I included some pictures. And the first picture, if you have there, shows what happens when there is no planning. And here the airport is in the middle of a whole housing development, which probably will be closed in the near future because of the noise that's created and the objections from the people. On the next picture is a picture of the airpark where I live in Independence, and it is a situation where we have the airport and the airpark adjoining each other, and they're both dependent on each other. The airpark providing a lot of the economic incentives to maintaining the airport, And the other is, you notice there's a lot of ag land. There's a lot of EFE land around this, which is very, very compatible to keeping an airport, because these are things. It also includes industrial development next to the airport, which is also compatible. The last picture shows an airport that is a airport within a industrial area, but also within a commercial area. And this one then also, though, it does show some degree of lack of planning, in that there are houses at each end of the airport, which of the runways, which would be an area where noise might be a factor for the people living there. And it's astounding to me that people move in to a house next to the airport and can't understand there's airport noise. And so pretty soon enough of them exist that they close the airport. And so we're concerned about this, and the reason why that we would appreciate if you would help us introduce this to the next legislature so we can solve the problem.
Okay. Any questions, any discussion on this?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Gentlemen, do you know, are there currently airports in our state that are in danger of closing within the next 18 months because of this situation?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, no, I don't know of any directly, in that we are looking at several, the one at Lebanon, one at Cottage Grove. Some of those are having some problems, and with encroachment and with zoning around the airport. And Aurora is another place where planning is necessary to maintain the airport and the communities around it.
Yes, I'm wondering if there's any fiscal that would be going with this. Have you gotten any?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, we really are too early in the process of drafting the bill. We haven't even sent it off to council yet. That it has not received legislative fiscal review yet, and it did not. It had no fiscal impact in the last session.
Thank you.
But it was a slightly different bill in the last session.
Thanks.
Too.
All right. Okay, and came to me late last week, and so I really haven't had a chance to even really think about this. And so I am not totally comfortable introducing this at this point, because I do wonder about the urgency. That's one of our judgments. The other one is controversy. Now, whether there will be much controversy on this, and not having sat on any committees and any knowledge of this, I'm curious whether you think this is a bill that might generate controversy and maybe be better to wait until 09 to do.
Madam Chair, of course, a bill which could be related to land use cannot be thoroughly devoid of controversy.
Right.
There is, I guess, no rush in this, and we're certainly not. There isn't an emergency outside of the potential for a Measure 37 claim throwing up some kind of a safety hazard close to an airport. But outside of that, it's probably not an emergency. We are generally, in the Ag Alliance, we're in favor of comprehensive land use planning. We think it just makes sense. And so we intend to use every session that we can to try to get a bill to introduce. But if this is not the right session for the introduction, then so be it. And we just appreciate all the help that you could give us if you decide not to introduce it as a committee bill.
Well, and I think it would be my choice at this time to do just a tad bit more research on this in the next couple of days and kind of feel out what people are thinking on it, and then it can go, because we won't meet again, I can make the request of the Speaker's office and possibly have it sent through rules if this is a bill that we want to pursue now as opposed to 09. So I appreciate, and I certainly would like
feedback from the committee if they have different feelings from what I am, because I want to make sure that we're...
I'm right along with you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair, yes. I might just say that this is one item that appears to need the review of a number of committees. You probably, this isn't just a transportation issue.
No.
It is a land use issue. It is
predominantly land use.
It is an issue which probably starts in a land use and then comes to transportation.
Yeah.
So as a result of that, I don't know that in a special session of 26 days, less the weekends, that you have the time that you're going to need.
What do you mean less weekends?
So, yes, go ahead.
Madam Chair, the question on urgency is that prior to passage of Measure 49, this was a real concern of our flying farmers in particular that had their strips out in the country, and there would be a large housing development within 650 feet of the runway. And so this does not have the urgency it had under Measure 37 previously to the passage of Measure 49.
All right. Thank you. And I appreciate your input, and I will be in touch with you.
Anything you can do to help, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, would be greatly appreciated.
Thank you so
much.
And so with that,
do I have a motion? You don't want a motion on?
On the previous bill.
Oh, I see.
Committee
okay.
Is so wanting to do that one, I guess.
Yes. Madam Chair, I move that the committee approve the drafting request that we have before these two speakers.
On
2936? That Mr. Minor brought?
Yes, the corrections to House Bill 2926.
Correct.
And so...
Call for a question.
All right.
any objections? None.
I'm out of practice, guys. So move.
That was easy.
And thank you, everybody,
thank you,
for
Madam
staying
Chair.
A little bit, and appreciate your work here.
Do you want to adjourn?
Oh, you're in the House of Transportation.